Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
I just hung up the phone. What's the best news I could have?
You want a four-week vacation to someplace else?
The best news I could have for me.
You got invited to Hillary Clinton's fundraising breakfast.
I got invited to Hillary Clinton's fundraising breakfast. Me, the first lady, scrambled eggs, lively conversation. Turns out it wasn't that hard. You know what you have to do?
Write a check for $1,000.
That's right. This isn't about politics.
She's running for the Senate.
This is about me. It's Hillary Rodham of Chicago. A connection.
There'll be a connection?
I believe there will be.
This really isn't political, is it?
No, sir, it is not.
You have a crush on Hillary Clinton.
I carry a torch for her, yes.
You're hot for Mrs. Clinton.
Well, who isn't? But in my case, it's more than physical, it's cerebral.
No doubt about it. I think we need to get you a CAT scan instead.
I would like to have an intelligent, high-minded, right-thinking, socially progressive, impressively pragmatic conversation with Hillary Clinton. Tomorrow morning, I shall.
Shall you?
Yes. And she will say, my goodness, that Dan Rydell is such a bright young boy. So much more than sports scores and highlights. I think I'll make him my gentleman friend.
It's okay, I'll be over here. Don't worry about it. You just stay on the phone as long as is necessary. Don't you worry, I'm sure everybody will wait.
I'm doing important show business, thank
okay.
you.
All right. Why, hello, it is 32 minutes after the hour of 1 in the year of our Lord, 2011, and this is the month of April. Thank you for joining us. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program coming to you live from the studios of the Emerson News Network, which are, yes, lushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious. They are also high above the milkpacking district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. It is April the 11th, 2011. If you'd like to be part of the program telephonically, maybe if you'd like to just give Dawn a call off the air so she can just sort of while away the hours, chatting up a storm while some of us are preparing to broadcast. Was that actually show-related?
It was.
It wasn't like a pair of shoes or something that came in order that you had to go pick up.
Yes, because I'm a lady, and you know how I love my shoes.
That's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah.
Was this the thing we were discussing before the for the show?
It was.
Yeah, excellent.
It was.
Fantastic. So. All right. It is 503-505-6964. If you'd like to take part in today's program, it's 503-505-6964. That is the number via which Aaron Duran will be joining us for the Weekend Geek a little bit later on. Also a Taser Watch coming up today. Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch. We'll recap last night's episode of The Killing on AMC, which was awesome. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian, will be joining us, and more. If you'd like to email, you can do that at rick@rickemerson.com. It is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed. It's Don, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com. Text box open on the website. You can also Skype. It's Rick Emerson Show. That is all one word. Via Skype, it is Rick Emerson Show, where Walter, who is listening in the Netherlands, says, Rick, thanks to... This is the sort of thing that never happens to me. Hi, Rick. Thanks to the fact that my wife is in Abu Dhabi until Wednesday, I get to listen live for a change. Best show ever, Walter, in Rotterdam, Netherlands. P.S. If you ever need an unpaid foreign correspondent, let me know. You had us at unpaid, sir. Excellent, yes. Consider yourself that guy.
Well, you know what they say. When the wife is in Abu Dhabi, the mice will play.
That's exactly what they say, Don. You know, I don't know where the Netherlands are. Is it more than one land?
Isn't it what we used to call Holland?
No, that's still Holland.
Oh, well, then I have no idea.
Well, I guess. I mean... It's very, very infrequently that I embarrass myself, but sometimes I just hear us say things... No, really. I mean, I'm pretty much, I'm immune to it at this point. I'm just numb to it. I mean, really, just the level, the bar has been raised so high. The level at which I would need to perform really to be ashamed of my own behavior is just like, I mean, I can't even see the bar. It's so high. But every now and again, you and I will just get into some sort of retarded who's on first kind of a thing. And I will just hear the things that are coming out of our mouths, and I just think, why? Why? How is it that we managed to live this long and to not somehow kill ourselves inadvertently? In any event, okay, now see, here's the thing. So now Walter, I should have asked him, actually. He's listening live in Rotterdam, Netherlands, says, sort of, but not really, about your thing of Holland. He says, it is Holland, and yet not, because technically it's made of 7 different provinces. So it is Holland, but it's still more than one place.
So Holland is part of the Netherlands, or?
And if there are Netherlands, I don't know what the opposite of nether is. If you have nether
regions.
Well,
you know what your nether regions are.
Right, but what are your other regions, though?
Your forefront regions.
Are they they're not further regions or father regions, or?
They could be. I think nether might be the opposite of further.
No, because that wouldn't make any sense.
Well, because further is more forward. So nether is.
I don't know that that's true. I think further is just a relative distance based on a fixed point in space. Because then if you have further regions and nether regions, then you must have regions that are the ground zero, in effect. They are the fixed point by
the
which.
Mid regions.
No, because that wouldn't make sense either. Okay, now he's just calling us from the Netherlands. This is how ridiculous the program has already become. That first a guy was emailing us from the Netherlands, then he was texting us. Now we have become such idiots that he is actually, I swear to Christ, a guy is, in the future, if anybody ever wants a measuring stick by which you will judge our idiocy, a guy is actually calling from the Netherlands, which may or may not be near other lands, to correct us. Hello, Walter. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great.
All right. By the way, with the recent...
Yes, it is. The whole region, country, is called the Netherlands. And within the Netherlands, there's the provinces of, like, South Holland, North Holland, Brabant, Friesland. So you are both right. It is Holland, and it is the Netherlands.
It's nice of you to say that, but who's more right? Is it Don or me?
Gosh. Well, I know which side my bread is buttered on, so I'm going to say you are.
That's right. That's exactly the way. That's the way we roll on this program. Well done. Hey, by the way, since the recent revamp of Skype, which I complained about because there were certain aspects of it that I found displeasing, one thing I do like is that when you take a call from somebody or, you know, somebody Skypes in, you now see their avatar in a much bigger window. It's not this tiny little thumbnail. So it now no longer looks like a boob. I can see that it is, in fact, the famed Golem. So well done,
oh,
Skype.
Perfect.
Hey, what is, if I can ask, what is your wife in Abu Dhabi for? What is that about?
She works for a software company that writes software for oil and gas industry. And she just had a meeting over there for 3 days.
Now, when you say that your wife is in Abu Dhabi, and so therefore you are able to listen, you're able to listen live for the next few days. Is it just that I'm assuming you're not henpecked in any way? Is it because there's just you were busy spending time with her, or just is there something she chooses to listen to during the day that then makes it difficult for you to hear this program live?
Oh well, it's not during the day. The time for us right now is 10:40.
All right. So is it like a scheduling thing that normally you would be retiring with,
yeah,
with your lady
I
for the evening?
Yeah, normally I listen the next day.
Okay.
And spend time with her and either watch TV or playing tennis, whatever. But yeah. I usually listen the next day. So I thought, hey, why not?
Do you actually spend a lot of time playing tennis?
5-6 hours a week.
Is tennis a, let me ask you that, is that a thing that you brought with you from the States, or is tennis a big thing in the Netherlands?
It's a pretty big thing.
If I were to ask you this right now, let me ask you this first. Is there some sort of bizarre or strange-seeming national sport or pastime there that would seem strange to our foreign eyes?
Oh, definitely.
They have a thing where they, like, juggle wheels of cheese or something?
Well, have you ever heard of field hockey?
Is that like field hockey like we have here, which is some big butch chick elbowing you in the throat and, you know, running down the...
Well, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, but it's a men's sport as well. And basically it's ice hockey, but you just run around instead of skate.
Excellent. Fantastic. How long is it? Hey, is she going to be in Abu Dhabi where they have that... Is that where that huge skyscraper was? They built like the world's tallest building or something?
That's in Dubai.
Dubai.
Yeah. Or right. Maybe it's up. Well,
I can't. Aha! Who doesn't know geography now, Walter?
Oh!
All right. Hey. I can tell he wasn't really stung by that. Excellent.
Yeah, zing.
You really got me, Portland guy. All right, excellent. As always, my friend, it is a pleasure. You, how long has she gone for? Just a few days, or?
Yeah, just a few days. She'll be home Wednesday afternoon.
Well, we're pleased to welcome you to the ranks of the live listeners during that time. You call us anytime, my friend.
All right, thank you, and you guys have a great day.
All right, thank you so much. All right, there you go. That's Walter, and that zing was priceless. That's like the best thing I've heard all week. All right, wonderful. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964, or if you are in the Netherlands or, you know, wherever, you could just Skype via Rick Emerson Show. That is our username. That's Rick Emerson Show. Hello, Don Taylor. How are you?
I'm just peachy. How are you?
I'm dandy. Somewhere between dandy and fine and dandy. I am not both. I am just one, but I am trending towards fine and dandy. No, I'm dandy. Nope. But I'm saying I may add fine to that by the end of, I don't know, who knows, within the next half an hour or so. All depends on how things unfold. So if I didn't do this already, so we got Aaron Duran coming up here in a few with The Week in Geek. Mr. Ryan White from The Oregonian going to be with us. Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch. We'll recap last night's episode of The Killing, and Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Monday.
Well, Brazil claims the largest Lego tower record. California Highway Patrol arrests a man named Eric Estrada, but it's not like the Eric Estrada.
That's
it's a different
bad.
Eric Estrada. And a suspect who was arrested after a slow speed chase lets off with a very amusing rant on camera, which is caught on video.
Do we have audio of
it? I do have audio of it.
Fantastic. Excellent. So that is all coming up. And again, that'll kick off with Aaron Duran here in just a few at 503-505-6964. Seemed like it's something else I was going to say about... today or something that was coming up today, but now it's just escaping me. I have no idea what it is. Anything?
I don't know. You mentioned Laura before the show.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got that. Well, we'll talk about that. We'll fix her little red wagon here
and
in a
second. And we have to figure out at some point we'll talk about The Killing, which we were going to talk about that, but we didn't.
We'll do that probably like, I don't know, like maybe 2:30 or so. We'll talk about last night's episode of The Killing, which, did you get that email from listener Matt?
I did.
That began with, I am stoned. But then he had like this like amazingly, I mean, I guess, not a surprise that it was lucid. It did kind of read like a thing that was written by a stoned guy, and yet not, because... It was very well put together,
articulate.
But it just sort of went on to make just the most minute navel-gazing points imaginable in a sort of wonderful way.
Yes.
So I may read part of that around 2:30 today. That is 2:30 Pacific time. We talk about last night's episode of The Killing. Before we do anything, I asked Ryan White if he had a chance to put this together, and he was not able to because he's sort of running behind and he's got a real job and whatever. But I came across what I believe to be, and we'll get back to this here in a second, but I came across what I believe to be the single most irritating song you could possibly hear if you were hungover. And this is because
More than that Rebecca Black Friday thing?
No, see, but that's the thing. It's like people say that, like, that's the worst song I've heard in weeks or months, or it's the worst song ever.
It's the worst song. I'm saying that song is like somebody, like, hammering a chisel into my forehead.
I don't think that is the worst song in any kind of category. I don't think, I mean, unless you just said the worst category, you know, the worst song ever made by somebody whose name was Rebecca Black that came out this year.
I was not saying the worst song ever. I was saying, you said worst song to hear when you had a hangover.
But I'm saying like that, but again, it's like, that's such a bold statement. I mean, in 100 years of recorded music to say that, like, you know, that is...
I mean, you could also stick me in a room and subject me to an hour of Philip Glass and, you know,
see,
I wouldn't like that either.
I'm just saying that might be worse. So I have what may be, I mean, I don't know for sure. But this may be the single worst thing that you could possibly hear while you were hungover. So we'll get to that here in just a bit. The reason I bring that up is because I'd like to thank... I don't even know. I was going to make you guess who it was, but I'll just say it out of the gate. I'd like to thank Aaron Duran for just triggering, like... Here's the thing about my wife, who is not in Abu Dhabi, by the way. She's in Bend, which is a less interesting version of that. And so it's not like I'm just saying this because she's not around or something. It's just sort of happenstance if that is the case. But I will say that my wife is not a person who's given to just getting blind drunk, like, as a, you know, just typically speaking, just as a matter of course in her life. It's not like she just gets, I mean, she drinks, but she can get flat out plastered most of the time. I mean, very rarely. And then I can count on fewer than five fingers the number of times in the last, you know, decade when she has just gotten absolutely unbelievably, mind-bogglingly drunk. But one of those times was Saturday night, because she went over to to Aaron and Jen's place to do some. I mean, it started as such an exciting evening. She went over to do some quilting because they got this whole quilt they're working on for.
Apparently, she finished it. She posted a picture of herself on Facebook wrapped in her quilt.
Yeah, she's like, I know, she's making a quilt for her mom or something, and it's like Jen's been sort of, you know, and Jen has, you know, is a I don't know, is skilled in craftology or whatever. She goes to the local scrapeteria and comes home with. Whatever. Anyway, so Jen was like walking her through how to do like a, I don't know, hook one, pearl nine, or whatever it is that you do with that stuff. But it's been like an ongoing project, like week to week to week, where she'd spend like 5 or 6 hours every Saturday night kind of over there quilting and clatching, as the ladies do. And by ladies, I mean Lara and Jen and Aaron. So Aaron just seems to show up, about halfway through the evening and about three quarters of the way into the bag most Saturdays. So I guess he came over on Saturday night. And he might have a different version of the events. All I know is that at one point, it was, I don't know, it was like maybe 2 or 3 in the morning. And I started, I looked up and I was like, well, that's odd. She should be home by now. She'd driven over there and she's usually back by this time of night. And then I got a text message from her saying, hey, staying a little bit later, having some drinks with Aaron and Jen. We'll get a ride if I can't drive. Don't worry about it. Be home late. And I'm like, okay. So I was just continuing, I was working away and doing whatever. And I was just working on some crap at home. And so I hear the dog start to bark, which means that she's at the front door. And this is at like 4:15, 4:30 on Saturday night into Sunday morning. I mean, it was late. It was late, late on Saturday night. And so I get up and I walk out into the living room. And I hear Jen saying, well, goodbye. We'll see you tomorrow and whatever. And so Jen and presumably Aaron are vanishing. And Lara's just standing in the doorway. And it's that thing where she just wasn't. Like, I thought something had spilled in the living room and she was standing there looking at it. Like, I thought maybe one of the dogs had, like, I don't know, had destroyed something in the middle of the house and she was standing in the doorway taking in the sight because she didn't appear to be moving. She was just standing in the doorway completely frozen, just totally immobile. And I said, hey, hon, how are you? And she just said, she didn't even answer. She just kind of went, and it was sort of a long exhale. And I just said, did we do some drinking tonight? Not really knowing the extent of the imbibing that she'd engaged in. And she said, yeah. And she just sort of whispered it and nodded her head. And I said, you know what? I'll go get the bed ready. I'll go make the bed and just, you just get yourself ready and I'll go turn down the pillows and whatnot for you. And I went to the bedroom and I just, I got the bed ready and whatever. And I did some pillow fluffing and I came back out. And this is the only time I've ever seen this, where she was literally face down in the middle of the living room on the carpet. I mean, like splayed out.
Oh my God.
Like she was making a snow angel on the rug in the middle of our living room. And I have never, ever, I mean, I've seen her really, really drunk 4 or 5 times, but I have never seen her where it's just like comedically like full on W.C. Fields drunk. I mean, she was face down, arms outstretched like she was a chalk drawing in the middle of our living room. And I just, and for a minute, I didn't know what, I mean, she clearly wasn't dead because she was sort of going like, but I just didn't really know what the deal. I just had no idea that she was that drunk because it's just not like her. And anyway, so I was never really able to get out of her that night, like what had happened. I wasn't able to sort of like, it was very unclear, like what the nature of the evening was. And so it was it would embarrass her if I talked anymore, but I will just say this, that the evening was, it was a night of fragmented sleep, for her.
Oh,
it was,
yeah.
Sleep interrupted by the various,
purging?
Yes. It was letting out of a lot of,
The poisons and toxins, leaving her body?
It was a lot of mini snatches of sleep interrupted by, I would say, periods of evacuation.
Yeah.
That took place often without any warning at all. And just it was that thing where, it's like silent, silent, silence. And just sort of an angry projectile vomiting onto. I mean, theoretically, it was going to be into a bowl that I had placed by the side of the bed. And by the way, let me just say, in case there's any. Any of you single folk out there, that's where you know, that's love right there. That's when you know that you have really crossed the threshold into an area of deep commitment to somebody. When you are, because I mean, it's like if you just meet somebody for the evening or you're just like somebody you're very casually dating. If something just starts coming out of one end or the other, like you're out of there. Like you are not, you're not sticking around for that. No. But that was where, yeah, she just, the night the night went into an ugly direction quickly once she was home, and it just stayed that way until the next morning. And I mean, it was like, and it was one of those things where it's like, when she was not up and vomiting, it's like I could have made any amount of noise. I mean, it's like I could have, the fire alarm could have gone off. I mean, I was trying to keep the dogs quiet and whatever, but I realized quickly that it wasn't, like, there was no point because there was nothing that was going to wake her up. So, anyway, so the next way, next day she woke up, and I woke up before she did, and I, you know, and I heard her kind of sort of like finally rousing around at like 10 a.m. or something. And I went into the, bedroom, and I just said, she was awake, and I said, hi, how you doing, sweetie? How's your morning? And before she said anything else, she just went, stupid, 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 stupid. You know, it's like this was like, like she was Philip Seymour Hoffman in Boogie Nights or something. And I just said, why? You know, that was an interesting night you had last night. I didn't want to say like, wow, that was the drunkest I've ever seen you. But I said, well, that was a different kind of evening for you. And she just looked up at me with that, just that look of like loathing for herself and for all of humanity at the same time. And she just said, Aaron challenged me to a drinking contest. I mean, which is like right there. You just, I just agreed with her that that was in fact a stupid thing for her to take part in. Now I am just telling the whole story. But yeah. I mean, it's like, why? I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, you're being challenged to a drinking contest by a big half-Mexican, half-Italian. You're never going to win that. I mean, that you've lost before you've even started. I mean, there's no way out of that that doesn't end in pain for you.
I'm not sure what the what was the end point supposed to be, because I've seen Aaron incredibly drunk. And the thing is, Aaron will get quite drunk on a fairly small amount of liquid. But then he will stay at that level through a considerable amount of continued drinking.
That's my question. As I said, well, like, did he get really, really drunk? And she said, well, he didn't seem to. He got drunk right away and then didn't get any worse.
Yeah, that's his way. He gets like 3 in him and he's in the bag. And then 12 later, he's still at that same point.
Yeah.
And it never gets any worse.
And it didn't appear to manifest any sort of, you know, any of the poor results or unpleasant symptoms that accompany severe drunkenness. You're right. He just, he hits a ceiling really, really quickly and then just, and then there's a stasis after that. And he just maintains. She did not maintain. There was no stasis. I mean, there was just a whole lot of like, and it's that, and again, we've talked about this before. We have that sort of understanding where, if one of us, you know, is going to be violently ill in some way, the other one just sort of like, oh, look, I got to go to the store for an hour and a half. I'll be back later on. And there was no time for that. And plus, I wanted to be around because it did seem like she was going to be having a long and unpleasant night. But I did, she walked in the front door, and you know, and again, with the face down on the carpet. And then I sort of went out and I kind of helped her up. And she goes, no, I'm fine. Which is that thing that drunk people always say, which is just like so, you wonder if it sounds like believable to them. Like if they actually believe that they are in fact fine, or if they know that it's not true, but they know that they have to say it. Like they go like, well, this is a lie, but it's a lie that I have to tell. Or if it's a lie that they have to tell, but they think that you're buying it somehow. Like, they think that you're not, you know, sucker bait, because you would not find in any world.
I think it's just the last tiny shred of your dignity just battling, you know, for supremacy. You know, against all other odds, you know, all evidence to the contrary, your pride just kind of pops up and says, I'm fine.
I'm okay.
I'm not pathetic and drunk and laying on the floor.
I can handle my liquor. I really can. And so I finally, you know, she got up on her feet and she said, no, I'm fine. And she was standing for, it really was a thing of just glorious timing. She stood up, she goes, I'm fine. I'm not so fine. And then she just ran for the bathroom. And I waited until I saw that she was going to make it to the doorway of the bathroom. And once she made it to the doorway of the bathroom, then it's like I went into the office and the office at our house is just like, it's like on the other side of the bathroom wall. So there's the bathroom, there's a wall, and then there's where I work most of the night. And so once she made it into the bathroom, I went into my office door and I shut the door, and then I just found, and it was immediately, I went for like Ride of the Valkyries on the stereo, you know, right? Just like the loudest thing I could possibly find. And I just, it turned it all the way up, and I just kept the dogs in there, you know, and every now and again, and there was that thing where like there would be a lag between songs, like song number one would come to an end, and then I would just hear sort of, you know, like happening next in the bathroom, and then blessedly the next song would begin, and the sound would be masked for a while, and then
oh god,
and she never in fact did come out and say like, I'm better. I'm done vomiting. All the demons have left my body. I've purged the wickedness from my veins. I was in my office with the door shut, and she just got done hurling, you know, for a while anyway, stopped on her way to the bedroom and just went and just hit the bathroom door three times and then went in and fell down on the bed as sort of a I am trapped in the hull of the ship kind of a way.
Oh,
and anyway, so then I went in and I carefully arranged and I said, do you need anything else? And she said, a sponge of some kind. And I don't know why she needed a sponge. I think that she may have been looking forward in the evening to the time when she was again sick and thinking again
she needed to
mop up or something, or that maybe that would be, maybe in her head she wasn't going to throw up enough that needed to require a bowl. It was like a sponge would be enough to just, you know, for the small droplets of spew that would, but there were, no. And anyway, so it was just a whole lot of, you know, I'll just put it this way. It's been a long, long time since I had to hold somebody's hair while they vomited.
Yeah.
Not since I had a bulimic roommate have I had to engage in that activity. So that's, but in a way, it was sort of nice because if you can get through that, like, that's how you know you're still in love, you know? That is, you know, the next day that I didn't go, we need to talk. I've been thinking about things. And like, if you can make it all the way through that, that's how you know that you're still, you know, you're going to stick it out for another 10 years or whatever, so... I probably did some other stuff this weekend, but I don't remember what. It was all just, that was the bulk of my energy over Saturday and Sunday. It was just spent cleaning up my wife's half-lifed lunch. So, how about you, Don? Oh, Aaron's joined us. That's nice. Okay, so we'll get him in just a moment. How was your weekend?
Oh, my weekend was fine. I was suffering from a small bout of the blues. I was feeling a little gloomy. So mostly I just sat around and I did some cleaning and some laundry and stuff, but mostly I just sat around and drank tea and watched from start to finish, this entire series called Cranford from the BBC.
It sounds very British.
It is. It was on in 97, and then there was a two-part follow-up 2 years later called Return to Cranford. I watched that, too. And it's like Judi Dench and Imelda Staunton, and there are these ladies, and it's 1842, and it's this little village, and everybody's worried that the railroad's going to come through and destroy their way of life, and somebody's cow falls in a lime pit, and people die in childbirth, and they worry what kind of hat they should wear to tea.
Not a comedy.
And it was, well, some of it was very, very funny. Like the cow that fell into the lime pit, it all of its fur burned off.
That does sound hilarious.
And so they were going to have to put the cow down, except that the lady bought a whole bunch of flannel and made it pajamas so that even though it didn't have hair, it wore these big gray flannel pajamas all the time. So it was like that sort of thing. And it was Judi Dench, and I love Judi Dench. But yeah, it was...
So was this just you and Fuzzy Slippers sipping tea and watching this British series? That was the bulk of your weekend?
Pretty much, yeah. I watched like 8 hours of this thing. I watched the entire series from start to finish over the course of the weekend while I drank tea.
Okay, then.
That was pretty much it.
And we're done. Just very quickly, actually, before we get to Aaron Durant, so I will I'll load this up here. So this is... For no readily apparent reason, I just I was never going to do this, but I started thinking as Laura was sort of fighting her way through this horrible drunkenness, and of course the next day, it's that thing where you ask the question even though you know that you know what she's going to say. So, how are you feeling? And of course it's like the morning after she's just been like unbelievably like galactically drunk, and I mean the answer is she's just feeling like hammered crap. I mean of course that everybody knows how she's feeling. Let's see if I can actually find this. So this is something that I found just lurking online, and I did come to the conclusion at one point that this would be one of the worst pieces of music that you could find. If you were hungover and somebody were just to sort of were to inflict this on you, let me drop the mono bed here and see if I can get this to play. This is let's see if I can just. So I was trying to imagine like waking up and you're really hungover, and what music could be playing like in the room next door. And the thing is, this goes on for like 7 minutes.
Okay, I can see that.
So I asked Ryan White, I think he'll end up doing it next week, but I asked Ryan White to put together a top five at some point of the the five worst songs you could hear while hungover. All right. By the way, you know, Lara's schedule is such that she doesn't really get to listen or call to the show very often. If and when she calls in at some point, this is going to be her new theme music. Just, we won't tell her why. All right. We'll just go ahead and use this. Let's go ahead and do this. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program. Where did I put my volume knob? Hold on a second. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program from geekinthecity.com, Mr. Aaron Duran. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good. How's everybody doing there?
Oh, well, everybody's fine here. I mean, in the studio. My wife, who, as late as Sunday night, was still feeling a little bit under the weather. So well done there. I guess I should congratulate you. I mean, I should sort of be angry because because she fought for the honor of our house and lost in spectacular fashion. But well done on your end.
Okay, well, hold on there. See, I was actually sworn to not talk about it at all.
Oh, well, that ship has sailed.
So apparently that rule got changed. There's a little difference in the history there. I actually was not the one who did any said challenging. She was actually calling me out because I wasn't drinking my space bowl fast enough.
Your what?
And I said, we went to the space room. So they call them the space bowls. They're huge, like, they look like fish tanks full of booze.
Okay. She said
I was not drinking mine fast enough. And I said, well, I'm enjoying it because I like how it tastes, because it tastes fruity and it's fun. And
is it some drink in particular, or is it just whatever you order served in a huge thing?
I call them, if you look on their menu, they have something called Space Bowls, and they have, like, the Purple People Eater and the Space Punch and, you know, the Warp Drive. They're all nerdy names, and, you know, so it'll be like grape vodka with, you know, grape juices, the Purple People Eater. Okay. They're frou-frou jinx, but, you know, they got an obscene amount of alcohol in them also. And, you know, she kind of give me yang for not drinking mine fast enough. And she says, I could take you down. And I slowly looked at her and I said, and this is what I remember this explicitly. I said, you really don't want to go there. Don't do it. Don't challenge me. Yeah, it's on. I can take you. I'm like, well, honestly, it's like a land war in Asia. You don't want to do this.
All right. So she was heckling you. No. So she was an instigator.
Well, yeah. Then apparently that was also just a giant ruse, a reverse psychology on my part, I guess, because there's no way she could deny my fake challenge.
Yeah, well, so she made it sound very much as though you were the one who had sort of, you know, like thrown down some sort of booze gauntlet in front.
No. But once the gauntlet was down, you know, I have to take my S seriously. So
we ordered another
round of bowls, and then I ordered shots of whiskey for everybody. And she's like, shots? I said, oh, you want to play this game? We're going to play it. We're going to go out Raiders of the Lost Ark style here.
All right. Okay. Well, I will mention that to her later and see what her reaction is.
But Don's right. I get the happy buzz really quickly, but then I'm able to maintain it for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
I'm not really a passer outer kind of guy.
And happy buzz is kind of an understatement, really.
Oh no, I get happy and loud and stupid.
Well, because I've never, like, I don't know, I've never known you to be, like, you're not, like, a punchy drunk. I mean, there's guys who get punchy and violent, whatever, and then there's giggly drunks and happy drunks and sort of angry drunks, and, you know, and then there's drunks who, like, you know, start snuffling about a puppy that, you know, that ran away when they were in second grade or something.
Yeah. Aaron is just Aaron only amplified.
Well, and
yeah, pretty much.
And I would say gropier, but, you know, but, you know,
oh, yeah,
well, more. Yeah, you know, just it is all of your pleasant and pleasing personality traits amplified, as Don said, to it, you know, just raised to a different degree. So,
well, you're moderately attractive and you have a pulse. Come here.
Yeah, I mean, so, all right then. Well, so I guess at the very least I can thank you for today's show prep. So, you know, because I didn't really have to, because really most of my Sunday was just spent walking around the house very, very quietly and or being gone altogether, so as not to exacerbate the headache that she was already working on. So well done there.
Yeah, I felt fine the next day.
I'll be sure to mention that as well before we do anything else. We get the appropriate music going here for the actual there we go. All right. So we talked a little bit in Legion of News about the Superman, about the Zod news, but I don't know the whole deal. So this is a done deal that Zod has been cast.
Yeah, apparently it is a done deal. They have cast Michael Shannon as Zod,
and this is the guy, the Prohibition agent from Boardwalk Empire.
Yes, he's also in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. He was in Valilla Sky. I mean, he's a decent actor, but he's one of those guys that kind of he kind of gets absorbed into the background of whatever movie he's in. You know, he's never really stood out in any of his works before. In fact, I'd say Boardwalk Empire might be his biggest role, you know.
I don't know that I've ever actually noticed him in anything else. I think it took Boardwalk Empire for me to go like, hey, who's that guy? Because you're right, he did.
Yeah.
And for such a kind of an odd-looking, very intense, kind of creepy-looking guy, he does tend to blend a little bit because he's been in a lot of things that I have seen and some things I've seen multiple times, and I've just never really noticed him. He didn't draw attention to himself, which I guess is sometimes the actor's job, is to sort of be there without, you know, you being aware of the actor. But so that brings to... So they've cast now three roles, right? Because they've cast Lois Lane, they've cast Superman, and now they've cast Zod. So, I mean, how...
Right.
Yeah. So
well, they've also cast Ma and Pa Kent.
All right, that's right, because it was Kevin Costner and... what's her name?
Kevin Costner and...
An equally bland and forgettable female counterpart.
An equally bland dame to just kind of fill the role of sitting in a farmhouse in Kansas. And I don't know if they're going to kill Pa Kent in this one or not. It's always kind of up in the air whether or not they're going to kill the dad or not in all these different incarnations of Superman.
Well, here's a dumb question. I mean, do we know the actual plot? I mean, if they're putting Zod in, I mean, do we know if he's the prime bad guy, or is it going to be, or are they going to start doing what they do to all of the superhero movies where they just have to pile on the villains so where, you know, Batman is, is fighting 700 people at once?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're claiming that this is, quote, not a total reboot, but also not in line with the, you know, the Donner or the Singer movies. So I think they're trying to hedge all their bets at once, which history has gone on to show over and over again in movies that that's actually a bad idea. You know, what you should do, with, especially with something like Superman, is you decide how you're going to want to go with it and then stick to it. Don't try and please everyone. You try and please everyone, you get Watchmen all over again.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like you've got to – I think, you know – Watchmen is a great example of that, of trying to put in a little bit of everything because you're afraid that otherwise the target audience isn't going to, you know, they're not going to, you're going to leave out somebody's favorite thing. And so as a result, a little element, a little bit of every single element has to be jammed into the film until the poor film can't even move anymore under its own weight.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Is what they tend to do with the superhero things.
And I don't think we really need origin stories all of the time.
Well, not for Superman, certainly.
Yeah.
Not for Superman. I mean, I could probably go to any country in the world and say, you know, and they would know Superman, you know, they would know Last Son of Krypton. I mean, they may not know all the nerdy details, but Superman has become one of those global icons. Everyone knows who he is and where he came from. So we don't need, you know, flipping 40 minutes of explaining why he exists, why he went to Metropolis, what he does in Metropolis, bumbling around the Daily Planet, trying to get his legs. Just be Superman.
By the way, speaking of the origin story of Krypton and everybody knowing this, I almost brought this up during Legion of News, but I held my tongue because I didn't want to get too sidetracked in Legion of News. And B, because we save all that for here, we tried to. And B, because I knew that you would be able to speak to this. Now, I'm not a Superman expert. I know more about Superman maybe than the lay person, maybe more than the average. I, for example, can reference Beppo the Super Monkey, you know, and that's not a thing that really helps me out of my life ever at all in any way. But, I mean, yeah. I can do it. So... But here's the thing. How is it – how do I put this? I know that sometimes continuity within the world of comics and comic characters is a little dicey, and they have to retcon a lot of things and whatever. But,
yeah, but every decade they retcon stuff, yeah.
Well, because forever it was like Superman, the last son of Krypton, the only survivor, no one else. But then it's like every 3 years they reveal like a whole new bunch of people who were like – also, like, snuck out, like, at the last moment before. Because isn't Zod and that whole cabal, aren't they all from Krypton?
Yeah, Zod and Ursa and Non are all Kryptonians also. But the way the kind of the story goes, which is actually there really wasn't a Zod until the Donner movie, is that they were put in the Phantom Zone before Krypton ever blew up.
Okay, so they would have been spared. They would have been spared. All right, because it was like, because I think I was on like Supergirl and Superman, and I was like, well, where, you know, were they all, I mean, do they give justifications for how all of the other super beings somehow were not blown up on Krypton?
Supergirl was a kind of a dumb one. Supergirl is Superman's cousin, and it was literally like just a couple blocks down from the House of El was, you know, Aunt and Uncle El, who were also scientific geniuses and were also realizing they had to send their only begotten child out into space because they also knew Krypton was about to blow up. So, you know, they're all chilling and there's earthquakes on Krypton. Brr, and all of a sudden they look down the street and, you know, it's like, hey, look, look what Jor-El's doing. Hey, what's he shooting? I don't know. Shove our daughter in our rocket and follow after him. And oh, no. That's kind of.
You just now became Chris Farley in Tommy Boy, and it was sort of awesome. Here's the thing I don't get about that, and I know that it's stupid. We're trying to insert logic into this sort of a thing, but I mean, if the Kryptonians, if they're a super advanced race of beings and they've got interstellar travel and whatnot, which they demonstrably do, wouldn't it have been an easier continuity fix just to say, like, she was out of town that day. She was at another planet fixing up a house, you know, or whatever.
Well,
in all the
multiple retcons, it's always been accepted, I guess, is that Kryptonians were also extremely xenophobic. And they were kind of like a – now it's getting just super wakey. They were kind of like the manifestation of Plato's Republic in how they treated lower classes and upper classes in their own society. And like I said, they're also extremely xenophobic, so they didn't go exploring at all. And they didn't let anybody come visit them either.
Okay. So they would have kept to themselves up until the moment when the big kaboom seemed inevitable. All right. Fair enough. Let's see. I know there's two other things we got to talk about. There's a Stumptown Comics Fest, which is coming up, which is going to be happening Saturday and Sunday, yes?
Yeah. This Saturday and Sunday at the Oregon Convention Center. You can find out more at StumptownComicsFest.com. It's just a fantastic festival. It celebrates all kinds of local and independent comics. There'll be panels there about writing for comics, for breaking into comics. We're going to have a podcast alley, which Geek in the City Radio is going to be there on Sunday. We're going to be podcasting from there. But the really exciting part is that I believe on Saturday they are going to be debuting the Sam Droid, the Project Merriman costume with Sam, and it was in the full outfit built by the Alter Ego Society.
So he must have tried. I mean, is this a thing where, like, they're going to present him with it and then he goes into the back room behind a curtain or something? Or is it like, is he at home right now sort of strutting around palace in it?
I don't know if I think he might have already tried it on, because about a week or so ago, there was a random Twitter post from Cable where he said, at City Hall, putting mayor in superhero costume.
That's awesome.
I love this city. Yeah.
That's the best thing ever. I mean, how many times in your life can you say that you had to go by and, you know, hook up them, you know, ensconce the mayor in a superhero costume of some kind? I mean,
totally. Excuse me, Mr. Mayor, we need to interrupt this budget meeting. We need to test your cape.
I like the idea that he's got it and he's just, like, you know, maybe wearing it just for fun around the house.
Wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'd, like, answer the door and I'd order pizza. I'd every task I could everything I needed to do to interact with the public, I would make sure that I scheduled it all on that one day. And I would just – and the thing is, if you're the mayor and you're wearing a superhero costume – you could probably just, you know, answer the door on that or go to work on that and just fix people with a steely gaze and just see if they even questioned it, or if they just went, I guess it's what he's wearing today. Don't look at
it. I would want to just start vetoing everything, even if I liked it.
Seriously.
And then Randy
just
Leonard.
At the middle of that council, you know, like, denied, denied.
Randy Leonard's trying to get a costume, but it's not as nice. And then you feel self-conscious.
Yeah. Totally. On my utility belt, I would just have a huge, like some sort of, like a veto gun that I use. just shot the word no onto the paper. So that's happening Saturday. The big unveil is happening for Sam Droid, the Merriman costume, and then it goes. It starts at noon on Sunday, noon until 6, and then it's at Stumptown Comics StumptownComics.com. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Fantastic. Yep. Finally, what is the? I know you had some Nintendo news, but I have no idea what it is.
It's still kind of a rumor. I think it's an unsubstantiated rumor right now, but there's a little kernel nugget of truth to it. The Nintendo Wii was wildly popular when it came out because it did, you know, it was pretty groundbreaking how you control the games. But since then, it's really kind of flatlined, and people are asking if Nintendo can even compete with places like the Xbox 360 and the PS3 right now. And the rumor out there is that since Nintendo still has that really strong eye for aesthetics and how you interact with their own games, is that they're actually going to turn to Apple, and those two are going to team up to effectively head on, you know, take on Sony and Microsoft in, you know, in the new console wars, as it were.
Well, that would make sense, because somebody asked me one time why, as though I know, but somebody said, well, why, you know, they were wondering, why hasn't Apple ever made a video game system, because there's so much money there? And my response was that because if Apple made a video, because the Apple video game system already exists, it's the Nintendo Wii. I mean, if Apple made a game console, it would be the Wii. And so it just seems they must have known that at some point, that there was no sense of trying to divide that up. This makes total sense that they would do this.
And Apple actually talked about it once, about entering into the video game market. And I think what it really kind of boiled down to is that even though, you know, Apple make fantastic computers and peripherals and stuff, it's a completely different beast and industry. And just as Nintendo didn't have the framework to enter the computing market, which they tried in the early 90s, which a lot of people don't remember, they did try it. Apple, I don't think, really had the infrastructure to enter the video game market. But it's that, you know, chocolate and peanut butter thing. They have similar aesthetic tastes. They're both, even though they look completely family friendly on the outside, they will just, from a business sense, completely savage you if they need to. It does kind of make a perverted sense that those two could team up and make a pretty damn interesting console.
They've got to be considering it because Apple is very much – we were talking about this with Google last hour that Google sort of – you know, if you ask Google, you know, which businesses do you wish to dominate? I mean, the answer is like all of them. And so it is with Apple. I mean, clearly Apple has – I mean, if you look at the number of industries that Steve Jobs, you know, and Apple, but, under the guidance of Steve Jobs, the number of industries that Apple has totally refashioned and reshaped. I mean, they have single-handedly, as a company, reshaped the music industry, the film industry, the computer industry, and arguably,
phones are designed. If you look at phones that were released within the same time period as the iPhone, companies like Nokia and Ericsson were making just these hideous, overcomplicated, spring-open, pedal-looking phones, and Apple puts out this little tiny brick and says, "Here you go, just touch it."
So it's phones, it's computers themselves, it's the music industry, it's the film industry through Pixar, and then there's all of the sort of ancillary changes they've made, not just with things like with the tablet the market, but also, I mean, you find me somebody right now who wants to buy stock in a company that makes point and shoot cameras. And the answer is no one, because that is to some degree because of the iPhone and because of the widespread adoption of those phones, that have, like nine, quanta pixel cameras or whatever in them now. So, I mean, it would make sense, just because they're, everybody's kind of on a race to be the one company that rules them all. So,
excellent. Awesome.
Yep. You can find out more at geekinthecity.com. That is geekinthecity.com. That is the home for all things associated with Erin Durant. So when Lara gets back to town, she's in Bend for a couple of days. I'm going to I'll try to get her side of the this. I'll be curious to know if she retcons the history herself and just if she acknowledges that she was instigating you, which I do inherently believe, by the way. That's the thing. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I instinctively believe that having heard your side of the story, that I totally believe that your version of events is correct. But I will be curious to know whether she sticks to that. So I will.
I did. I warned her. I honestly did.
Okay. You tried to steer her away, but she
I really
would not.
Did. But it's like there's only so much a man can take before it's like, all right.
No,
fine.
It's true. No, you at a certain point, you do have to defend your own honor, sir. So I commend you. All right. Erin Durant, find out more at geekinthecity.com. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Erin Durant. All right, we're so over time. We'll do this. Come back with Mr. Ryan White from The Oregonian and Don Taylor with the news desk. Stay there. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Go nowhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio program. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964 coming up later on. We got your Taser Watch coming up, Corpse Watch, Snuff Watch. We will recap last night's episode of The Killing on AMC, which is awesome, by the way, which is fantastic. So we got episode 3, season 1 of The Killing last night at AMC. We will talk about that. In just a moment, we'll go to the news desk with Dawn Taylor. Won't we, Dawn Taylor?
Yes!
What are the odds right now, if I were to ask you, the odds that you will become violently ill at some point during today's program? 1 in 3? 1 in 10?
Maybe 1 in 10, probably. Right. It's not really...
Is it more of a swirling or a sloshing or a rumbling?
It's a rumbling. It's that thing where you can just feel that things are kind of moving through your intestinal tract. So it just kind of goes...
It goes... I'm sorry, it goes what? Excellent. All right. Hey, I have a question.
If you want at some point, I can't probably put the microphone to my stomach.
We got a spare microphone, though. I might do that at some point.
Okay.
I think I might have a lavalier around here somewhere. We can just and just clip it right onto your your shirt there. Just sort of, you know, just sort of a, you know, like a sort of aural fantastic voyage.
But when I get that look on my face, like I'm just thinking about something really hard, or I'm distracted. Really, it's me just kind of going, oh, there goes my stomach again. So that's what it is. Although Ryan White said that he has had a rumbly stomach as well. So
Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. How's your stomach doing today, Ryan?
Rumbly.
All right. So is there a thing going around? Is there some sort of a... Because there was that whole thing everybody had.
It's called
like,
life.
The sinus impacting or the whatever. I asked Sarah the other day, she said she felt a little ill, and she said she felt like she was... It's the worst thing. She said she felt like... I apologize in advance for this. She had some sort of a sinus problem, and I said, well, you know, are you just sort of congested, or are you just... She goes, oh, it feels like I'm smuggling a lot of cottage cheese in my head, which is really an image I didn't need, but I mean, at the same time, it is very, very illustrative of, I think, that does help to convey the precise nature of her illness. Hello, Ryan White.
Hello.
So we were actually just talking during the break about this. We were all just comparing. We just turned into everybody's like grandmother talking about like the pain I have all up and down my left side, and the doctor says there's nothing he can do about it. But then I have this bunion, and you were
getting old.
Talking about your and Dawn and I observed. I think
is it cold in here?
Well, we were complaining about how it was too hot. And so this room, by the way, is in fact much cooler than it typically is because we were complaining about the heat. And I actually, the last couple of days, it started the day that Eric Snyder was in last week. I noted that there was a real chill in the room, but I realized that by definition, I am not allowed to complain about it. Like, that's the thing. We've nagged them forever and ever about the heat. Also, the guy who was here to fix the heat was a listener of ours. And so it's like, there's several ways in which I cannot complain about the temperature in here. You weren't really asking that, though. You were just
I was just being an old person.
Okay, so maybe it's just me. So maybe it's just my phlebitis.
I think it's perfectly fine in here.
That is acting up. Do you ever just live in fear of that, though, of like the day that you do become, when you wake up and you start going, you know, well, my elbow is hurting because of the rain that we're going to get. And that's just like there's going to be some sort of a tell that you will, that you have crossed the threshold into old age.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to tell the difference between just the regular aches and pains that I've created for myself and then the weather changing. I mean, my knee just hurts.
Well, we were talking about this during the break about our various stomach ailments. And so Dawn and I were, Dawn actually said, well, aren't you eating better? Aren't you eating healthier now because you're a parent? But it's my experience that when you are a parent, you just eat whatever the kid eats. So it's like your just diet is graham crackers and apple juice for 5 years.
No, it's not even quite that. You eat, or at least in my case, I eat when I have time to eat. And it's usually like I'm almost always on the go. And then there are days like, you know, Fridays I'll work from home and take care of her. So when she naps, I kind of have to get a lot of work done. I usually don't eat on Fridays. I just don't have time to eat.
You're just trying to get as much done as possible.
There'll be like a box of Triscuits open, and by the end of the day, the box of Triscuits will be gone.
Yeah.
But that's not a meal.
So you've just defaulted to...
I've had like seven cups of coffee and a box of Triscuits by the end of Friday.
Maybe not to you.
And then I switched to beer.
All right. Well, see, now I feel really self-conscious about my own eating habits because that's, I mean, it's, you know, and I have no excuse because it's like, A, you know, I don't have a kid that I'm taking care of. And then also, you know, my wife in the last few years has started, you know, she's kind of discovered this love of cooking. So there's like stuff that is like made from you know, more or less from scratch, like actual decent homemade food. But of course, it's just, I have just gotten, it's like grooves in a road where I'm just with the, you know, with the box of Triscuits and the, you know, and the cheese and the can and the whatever, which I just, that is what I default to. Like if someone doesn't physically like put me in front of regular food and make me eat it, I just won't. So
I've got friends who are foodies, and I think that's interesting. But food is just something that I need occasionally to get me through things. I don't really care where I eat or, you know, when I'm on vacation, I suppose I like to eat well, but other than that, I don't care.
See, I think you and I may be on the same page in that, and my wife, and I've had several people say this, but my wife sort of, she will sometimes in her more, if she's feeling somewhat irritable, she will complain about this. She'll sort of grouse at me about this or carpet me about this, as my father used to say, that she sort of resents. That she resents people. She'll always say people like you, but she resents people like me who. Because I'm just sort of indifferent to food is my thing. Like, there aren't foods I prefer.
And, well, you're very passionate about snack foods.
I have opinions about food. Like, yeah, I mean, I have stuff that I don't like, and I have stuff that I think tastes really good. But at the same time, it's like if you just told me, look, you know, for the next week and a half, you're going to have you know, tamale pie every night for dinner. It's a thing. I would just say, okay, you know.
A friend of mine who's especially foodie will just look at me sometimes and say, food is wasted on you.
Yeah, I mean, but that's kind of the thing with me. It's like, you know, there's stuff that you probably like, but at the same time, like, you're not, you know, like, if it doesn't show up, then, you know, whatever. You know what I would totally be fine with is – for the longest time, I have wondered why this isn't a thing you can really have. This is right up there with flying cars and cloud cities. I want that thing from RoboCop, where it's just that machine that dispenses the rudimentary paste, where the guy just, you know, they just extrude that brown sludge into a cup, and then, you know, his digestive system is extremely simple. And then they, you know, I would totally eat that. I mean,
there must be something like that.
Dawn?
Would I eat that? Or
your digestive system
like
is extremely simple. Why? No, why? You know about food. I mean, is there just some rudimentary sludge I can eat that just is everything I need?
There is actually this stuff. I don't know where you buy it, but I read about this a year or two back. This company created a paste that comes in a tube that's manufactured primarily from peanuts. And they were trying to get it up and running so they could send it to third world countries, because one tube actually had all of the nutrients you needed for an entire day. And apparently it tasted pretty good. It tasted just sort of like this super thick peanut paste, but it's like super calorie dense and has lots of protein and all the fat and everything that you need. And they were trying to, and it's cheap. So they were trying to like get like the government to buy it, to take it to like the Sudan and stuff,
right,
for like all the starving kids and things. But yeah, you know, if you could find yourself like a case of that, you could, you know, live on that for a while.
The Sudan, and then for like NHL players who break their jaws but don't want to quit playing.
Well, that's my thing is, like, you talk about the liquid diet that people get put on if their jaws are wired shut or something. If you take it as an article of faith that most food is largely water, because most things are water, you know, most organic matter. If most food is water, doesn't it seem like you ought to be able to do the Wonka thing of just taking like a 3-course meal and reducing it down to the size of like your fist, you know, or if that, and then just, you know, and then you just have it in several, you know, a handful of large capsules that you take in the morning, and then bam, you're good. I mean, I don't know what the X factor is. It seems like that ought to be fairly easy to do, where you just blend everything down into some puree, dry it, stick it in a pill, I take it, bam, done.
Kind of baby food. At the end of the day.
Okay, now I've wondered about that too, because if you figure baby food is sort of balanced in a way that, you know,
my wife will take and make, you know, something that we've had, and she'll just kind of throw it in the food processor, puree it, freeze it into little bits, and then she pulls them out occasionally and unthaw them and feed them to the baby.
I would absolutely do that just as a time saving measure.
Well, I love food. I think we know that, but I get periods where I'm just sick of food, and I'm sick of thinking about it. But of course, I still get hungry, and that's when I just will go like a day or two where almost all I eat are protein shakes, and just throw, you know, little milk in the blender and a handful of ice and a banana and a couple of scoops of protein powder. And then I'll just drink it. And then I go, okay, that was food. And I can get on with my life.
See, how great would that be? I mean, it's like, because to me, it's like food is sort of a, and this is another thing where people I know who are very into food will be sort of irritated by this statement, but it's just my own take. Food to me is sort of like sleep. That it's just this thing that I have to do, and it kind of pisses me off. I mean,
no,
like
sleep, I like.
It's
especially
like,
now that I don't get any.
It's not that I don't enjoy it. I mean, it's like I enjoy eating pizza. That's fine. I mean, there's food that I enjoy, but it bugs me that I have to do it. Like, to me, I wish sleep was sort of optional, like a thing I could just do recreationally. It irritates me that every now and again I will simply have to stop working and sleep. It's just that my body just sort of will start shutting down. Just,
see, here we're opposite. There are often times that I'm angry that I have to be awake.
Yeah, but those moments are always – that's followed. Like the moment where I'm where I'm angry that I have to sleep, that's followed like about 4 hours later when the moment that I'm just infuriated and depressed that I have to that I have to wake up. So there was – in the 90s, there was that book series that they put out, and it was like the book of questions or whatever. It was, it was like a bunch of weird philosophical and moral and ethical questions that I think you were supposed to get high and sit around your dorm room and ask each other questions all night. But one of them was – would you trade half of your worldly wealth and possessions for the ability to subsist on 1 hour of sleep a night? I mean, and that's ideal. Like every now and again, they'll have these study, and it's always in Britain for some reason. Every now and again, they'll find some woman living in like Brixtershire on Zems or whatever, some tiny village on the outskirts or wherever. And it'll be like, Enid Schlarp is 85 years of age and she gets by on 1 hour of sleep a night. Scientists didn't believe it until they tested her. And then they'll just show some old British woman who's like, well, I've just never needed to sleep very much. And you wonder, like, well, why couldn't I have been blessed with that? And plus, it's always just like she's like a goat farmer, a place where it doesn't – who cares if you're sleeping or not? I mean,
the goats.
I guess that's a fair point. The goats are probably grateful for that. But I could use that ability to a much greater degree than she probably does.
Yes.
All right. Well, in any event, how I do go on. What is going on in the world of music, Ryan White?
Sick and tired of this weather. I'm leaving and going to Palm Springs on Thursday. So.
Well.
Okay. Well, la-di-da. Never mind then.
Coachella Music Festival this week.
That's a thing that I know so little about. It's one of those things that I hear about every year.
You and me both.
And it was like the Sasquatch, or for a while, for a long time, it was like the Bumbershoot thing that I sort of read about or heard about, but I never went to it. Who puts it on? Where did it?
It's a company called Golden Voice. It does it. It's a concert production company down in.
So it's not like a band. Like it's not like one of those Perry Farrell things.
No,
where a guy,
no,
like, put it together.
Or that new Wilco curated festival that they're going to do for the second year. It's kind of, if you don't count South by Southwest as being, as being a music festival per se, it's the first of the big music festivals in the United States, kind of kicking off the whole festival thing. And what I think we've seen over the last couple of years is we're moving closer to what Europe's been like for a while. And there's a really big festival circuit. And this year you're seeing a lot of the same bands playing all of these festivals, and they're huge paydays for them.
Is that a financial thing? Because bands just can't afford to tour individually anymore?
Well, a lot of them are touring anyways. I mean, a lot of what's going on here with the sold-out music festival right now, they're capitalizing on bands routing West Coast tours around Coachella. Like Black Joe Luce and the Honey Bears were here last night. They're playing Coachella. Rafael Sadiq tonight, Coachella. Lauryn Hill, who I heard was horrible on Saturday at the Schnitz, Coachella. So you can capitalize on that, but it's a way to reach a lot of people. The Decemberists are playing three or four of these things. They're not doing Coachella, but I've heard from some people, they're getting like six figures for one set.
Well, I guess if you can draw, and I mean, what's the attendance like at?
Oh, I don't know they sold out immediately. I bet it's probably 40, 50, 60,000 people for the weekend over, multiple stages. And
you got to figure if the band is,
well into the night.
They're getting paid whatever. And then depending on who you are, who knows, maybe they negotiate some percentage. And then, but they got their merch sales and all of that on top of it. So it's
worthwhile.
Well, and bands, I think, have got to multitask like that in a way that they didn't used to. I mean, I don't think it used to be that way where it's like, Led Zeppelin would come to town you know, and then also they were like doing a show with like, you know, with Deep Purple and the, you know, and yeah. whoever, you know, the Doobie Brothers across town the following night. I just don't think that they used to have to do that. But I think that the music industry just can't be, it's not front loaded with profit the way it used to be. So you gotta kind of hustle a little bit more.
Yeah. And if you can stomach the crowds and everything, you know, these festivals are great for the music fan. I mean, I've been of the opinion for some time that they're to be endured more than enjoyed, although I had a blast in New Orleans at the Jazz and Heritage Festival when I went a couple of years ago. Pickathon is always great. They've got that thing down pat right now. And again, we're, you know, I think we've said on here before, everybody's just kind of waiting for that year at Pickathon. We're like, oh, should have been here last year.
Right, right.
And, you know, this year you saw a lot of people complaining about the Coachella lineup, saying, oh, you know, it's beginning, the last year's was better. And used to be a little bit more riskier. And, you know, this year you've got your headliners, you know, I think Kings of Leon is the one that's pissed off the most people being on there. I mean, otherwise it's, you know, it's Kanye and it's Arcade Fire and, you know, they've got, I think Kanye will put on a great set. I'm looking forward to seeing that. The first night CeeLo's way up on the bill. I think he'll be great. Black Keys will be there.
The Kings of Leon is one of those bands that, I mean, largely because of the KUFO thing, that they could put out like the best record in the history of civilized man, and I just don't think I would be able to. I don't think I would be able to work past my
side with the pigeons.
Yeah, I mean that really is it. But it's just their insufferable blandness. I mean that's the thing that I just
that's what makes you big in America. Ask Jim Nance.
That a friend of mine used to say, he had this, which I think he actually did coin this phrase in response to the news story that the Hootie and the Blowfish album had passed like 14 million copies sold or something. And he sort of, the irony here is he was reading it in USA Today, but he threw down the newspaper and he said, for anything to be successful in America, it has to contain an air of mediocrity. And then he stomped off to the bathroom and he actually ducked back and he goes, write that down. And then he left. But I mean, it really is true. I mean, it's like if you can just find something. I mean, and that's like it doesn't surprise me that her performance was apparently terrible at the Schnitz. But, but that's like the success of Lauryn Hill. I remember when that happened. It was just, and to me, it was such uninspired, just absolute middle of the road blandness in so many ways. Yeah. When she sort of broke through and was a huge, huge deal. It doesn't surprise me that she was terrible because I had heard, I mean, everything I'd read and all the reports here is she was done with music because she had just gone nuts. And so I don't know whether maybe that is true, but somebody at some point looked at her ledger and decided like she needed to get back out and make some money, and they just kind of shoved her out on tour.
And so, you know, I guess wherein I feel bad for the people who paid for it. You know, I wasn't there. I saw an unbelievable set in a sold-out Dante's last night by Black Joe Lewis and the Honey Bears. They, you know, it was an early set last night because they had to get Sinferno in.
Right.
And so they come out for the encore, and they bring out two of the Sinferno dancers for two of the three songs in the encore. And, you know, Joe's already got centerfolds taped up, you know, cut out and taped on his guitar to begin with. So it was just – it was hot and it was sweaty. And I was joking with somebody with a buddy of mine that I was with. I said, you know – I go, if politicians really want to get serious about unwanted pregnancy, they need to immediately defund Black Joe Lewis and the Honey Bears, because that's just music that makes you want to start taking clothes off.
And Dante's is a perfect example of a place that is, depending on the act you are seeing, because there are a few things worse than seeing a bad show or a terrible act in a small, crowded club. But of course, the opposite, the polar twin to that statement is that there are a few things better than seeing a great act in a tiny club.
And at one point last night, they're 7 members with 3 horns, with a horn section. Then they brought out the Great 8 Brass Band, and so they went up to 13 people on that stage with, you know, just a pile of horns and drums and guitars wailing and, you know, him doing his James Brown howl.
And, you know, and in the right, with the right combination of just the crowd and the performer and the vibe and the whatever, it almost doesn't matter whether you're familiar with all the songs, whether you know the band that well or not, because it can be difficult to enjoy or judge a band if it's unfamiliar music to you. Mm-hmm. But there are those magic confluences where it just, there's you know, just that really, really rare, kind of transcendent combination of forces in the room where I saw years ago, but I saw a band that I don't even know if they're still around anymore, but a Canadian band called The Tragically Hip. Mm. And The Tragically Hip, who were huge – this sounds so retarded, but they were huge in Spokane, largely because Spokane has this proximity to Canada. And so they would always – Canadian bands would always just make like a hop over into Spokane before they would head back. And so they would do this swing all the way to the east. They would duck down into Spokane, and then they would go back up. And so living in Spokane, you would just see this constant like procession of Canadian bands you were touring. They would come down. And I saw The Tragically Hip, who I think I'd only ever heard about. And I'd never heard them. I didn't know any of their music. I didn't know anything about them. But a friend of mine was like, you got to see them if they come to town. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who they are. I don't know any of their songs. He's like, doesn't matter. He's like, you got to go see them. And I saw The Tragically Hip play this tiny club in Spokane, whose name eludes me now. And it was minuscule. But I got to tell you, it was just one of the best shows that I have ever seen in my life, not knowing a single one of their songs. And it was because, you know, a combination of the crowd being into it, them being into it, and just there's that – I am always – here's a thing I'm really jealous of. Not the bands that, you know, you didn't see, you know, back when, because that's a thing that everybody sort of laments. But it's like you – I never live in one of those towns where it's like – the Stones come and they play the, you know, the Colossal Dome, and then later on they hold court at a club, you know, downtown, where they show up unannounced and play till 4 a.m. I have never lived in a town where that happens.
Well, that was last time Prince was here at the Rose Garden, he went from there to the Roseland and played until about 4 in the morning.
Wow. And is it with something like that? I mean, this sounds dumb, but do they call the venue in advance, or does he just like show up at the door with his, I'm Prince, you know, and just like, I am funky, and just demands that they let
him
in.
They must set that up. They must set that up ahead of time.
I guess if you're Prince, you have people for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you have an organization.
I guess. It's, see, and now I'm getting all the, I saw so-and-so back play at the tiny club with whatever, blah, blah, blah. So that is, you know, that's one of those things that is only obvious.
You live in that town, just nobody tells you.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Well, I lived in L.A., and I only have
I don't know the right
two
people.
Experiences like that ever. One was I saw Chris Isaak at McCabe's Guitar Store before he actually got famous. And the other was I actually got to see Tin Machine at a club before anybody almost no one knew that Tin Machine was fronted by David Bowie. Just all of these flyers started showing up around town and somebody said, you know, I think that's David Bowie's. And we're going, no, it can't be David.
You're lying.
Bowie. So it's some club was like, holy crap, that's David Bowie. So, but that was it. Other than that, I never got to do any.
So clearly, I just need to travel in a better circle of friends, so I can be alerted to when those things are taking place. Whatever happened to Tin Machine?
I don't know. I think Bowie did with it what he wanted to, and then just
is that one of those things where he just woke up and
be gone.
He's like Neil Young. He just spun like a roulette wheel of music, you know, that morning. And no, I'm now going to create Zydeco music or whatever, and just sort of moved on to whatever.
Fuzzy. Yeah. Acoustic. Fuzzy.
He does that sort of Lou Reed, Neil Young thing of just like swinging the musical pendulum sort of back and forth. So here's the thing about Tin Machine. The thing about Tin Machine that I liked is that because of Tin Machine, I was introduced to the Sales Brothers, who have gone on to produce some records that I quite liked. And plus, you got to like a band that, you know, that has Soupy Sales' two kids in it. So, I mean, there's, you know, something to be said for that. Jesus, God, it's 2:45.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
All right. Here's Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Well, we should do our snuff watch before we move on.
Oh, I'll take it. Where's my the thing with the who's it and the what now? Here's your snuff watch for Monday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here's Don Taylor with your Snuff Watch.
Legendary director Sidney Lumet has died at the age of 86. The New York Times reported early Saturday that Lumet, a four-time Oscar nominee, died of lymphoma. Lumet, who began his career directing theater and then television, helmed countless big-screen classics. His first film, 12 Angry Men, established him as a top director.
His first film?
In 1957.
Oh, F that guy.
While his 1970s hit Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, and Network sealed his reputation as a screen legend. While he never won an Oscar for the films he directed, in 2005 he was awarded an Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement.
The best thing about that Lifetime Achievement Award is that I don't know if it was actually at the ceremony itself or if it was like when he was interviewed directly afterward. You know, he's in the autumn of his years and whatever, and he's holding, you know, he's finally been honored by his peers, and they ask him what he thought about it, and he goes, well, God damn it, I deserve it. which was sort of great. You know, because like, hey, I mean, because it was only a few years ago. And I mean, who's going to disagree with that guy?
Well, a lot of his movies, like Prince of the City, Night Falls in Manhattan, and Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, took place in New York, and sort of a hard-edged New York at that. And he had been asked of his favoritism towards New York in an interview in 1997. And he said, it's not an anti-L.A. thing. I just don't like to live in a company town.
Yeah.
So he didn't work in Los Angeles, but he maintained good relations with Hollywood studios, partly because he finished his pictures under schedule and under budget. His television beginnings had schooled him in working fast, and he rarely shot more than four takes of a scene.
And it was, and you just look at the track record that that guy's had. I mean, it's just his the number of I had no idea that 12 Angry Men was his first film, which is just – I mean, I guess if he had a background in TV, that explains a lot, because that's basically just a staged play. And one of my favorite films of all time, as is Network, you know, and Dog Day Afternoon, is a movie that I want to like a lot more than I really do. But I mean, I admire the energy of it and the sort of, you know, and Serpico is, you know, you can't take anything away from that.
Dog Day Afternoon is one of those movies that it was one of the movies that I saw when I was young enough to just start loving movies. And I think I've always looked at Dog Day Afternoon as one of the first movies that made me really think about the process of filmmaking and acting and just how they're all put together from a storytelling perspective. He also directed Failsafe, which is the film that basically Dr. Strangelove
Peter Fonda is
largely built on. The Pawnbroker. He directed Equus. He directed The Wiz.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
But he also directed Eugene O'Neill's Long Day Journey Into Night as a film, Arthur Miller's A View from a Bridge, Tennessee Williams' Orpheus Descending.
Wow.
I mean, he made a lot of movies. He made a lot of really great movies. And he's also one of the few directors who was considered an actor's director, that he got great performances out of his actors without having ever been an actor himself. A lot of guys like Sidney Pollack were considered actor's directors because they dealt with actors really, really well. But Pollack himself had started out as an actor. And Lumet is just one of those guys that apparently everyone loved working for him. So,
well, and he made I think I had just sort of forgotten about the fact that he made Failsafe, which is, I mean, it's, and I mean, the last time anybody saw the original Failsafe with Henry Fonda. But I mean, it's like, you want to talk about a movie that just ratchets and ratchets and ratchets until you feel like your nerves are just at the breaking point. I mean, I saw that again, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, and I hadn't seen it for 5 or 10 years. And I mean, it's just I always want to say spoiler, but the movie's like 1,000 years old. So I mean, if you haven't seen it, you know, by now, I mean, that's on you. But when is the last time you saw Failsafe?
It's been a while. I remember I actually had a teacher who had us watch it when I was in high school, and that was the first time I ever saw it. And then it has to have been like maybe 10 or 12 years since I saw it last.
Jesus, there's a couple points in Failsafe where it's like you just. And I mean this in the best way, because it's just a masterfully effective film. If you have never seen Failsafe, really, I cannot even overstate how great it is. But there's moments where you want to scream because it's like you feel like you cannot take the tension. Another set, you're like, I can't bear this. It's just, and they, you know, and no disrespect to a guy like Alfred Hitchcock, who got labeled, I think, something of an overstatement, as the master of suspense. And I think in Hitchcock movies, suspense is just sort of code for nothing happens for long periods of time. And like the camera just sort of like watches Suzanne Plachet like wander around a town or something. But you watch Failsafe and you realize where he is just like tightening just the cables of the movie, like until they're just like piano wire. And you just want to scream or something to happen to break the tension. And then when it does, in a way, it's almost worse because it's the tension being broken by something that is just horrible. There's that moment in Failsafe when Henry Fonda is on the phone and he's talking to the pilot and trying to get the pilot to turn back because they are, you know, accidentally going to bomb Russia. And there's that sequence where Fonda just, who has tried to remain really calm and in control, his composure just breaks and he just says, "This is the President of the United States," you know, and he screams it, and the pilot just says, you know, "I'm sorry, but I have to disregard verbal commands at this point, Mr. President," and continues going on. And then there's the final, you know, 2 minutes of the film or whatever, which is just a series of still images of New York seconds before it's bombed, you know, by because they ordered New York to be bombed as a sort of apology to the Russians, which is like, I can't even. And you watch it now. I mean, it gives me chills just thinking about it. You watch it now and it's horrifying. I cannot imagine. When did Failsafe come out? It's like 61 or something, or maybe post-Cuba Missile Crisis?
Yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, it was, you know, had to have been no later than the mid-60s. I can't imagine how traumatizing it would have been to have seen that movie then. I mean, it must have just – here's the thing. We were just talking about Sidney Lumet. We were just talking about bands that, you know, we didn't see in clubs, you know, when they just do surprise gigs, or bands you didn't see in clubs back when. We have probably had this conversation before, Donna, but I'll ask Ryan as well. If there was a movie that you could go back and see in the theater during its original run that you did not see in the theater during its original run. In other words, you know, you could magically transport yourself back to when it's first in the theater, so you didn't know anything about it. Nobody knew anything about it.
Oh, wow. Casablanca.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice.
Well, it is. Casablanca is, let me change that. Chinatown.
Okay.
I think I would pick Chinatown. Those are the two most perfect movies I can imagine. And I think it would be interesting to see audience response to it when it was new, before they'd been seen to death and dissected to death and you know, reconsidered and, you know, over and over again.
I mean, especially Casablanca, because it's become such a part of the culture.
And it was just another sort of, it wasn't even an A-list film when it was released. It was part of the slate of films that was just coming out, and it was not by any means like, you know, a gem of a movie. That,
right.
You know, it was yet another, just another throwaway.
People weren't expecting much
sort
from
of
it.
B film for the studio. So yeah.
Ryan, if there was a movie, go back and see the original run.
I like both of those choices, honestly. I'm trying to remember. I don't think I saw Raiders in the theater.
Really? And I
don't think I did. And I think that's one that, for any number of very obvious reasons.
Well, yeah, because again, it's like, I mean, even though it is Lucas and Spielberg, I think because they were resurrecting and executing pretty flawlessly a genre that had not been seen by anybody, certainly in our generation, by a lot of people, it was probably a thing like the sort of you know, serials, the chapter plays have been. I think everybody sort of heard about them, and you know, and people of Spielberg's generation had seen them. But I think there was a whole group of people who only knew about them by reference and had never seen them. And so the idea, plus, let's be honest, I mean, that Raiders is probably better done than 90% of those that aired, you know, in the 40s. And that's a great choice. I think it would have been Network, because Network as great, and I love Network. It's one of my favorite films. But as brilliant and as prescient as that movie seems now, it must have just because the thing is, you watch Network now, and it you can recognize how prescient he was. But of course, there's that strange thing about Network where at the time they didn't know that, and at the time they had no idea. I think that it would all turn out, that it would all come true, that he was just showing this. You know, this absurdist, exaggerated, satirist version of what television does to people, and of how television warps your morality and your senses. And I don't think anybody conceived the extent to which that movie would transpire in the real world. And so to see it stripped away of like modern technology and modern television and modern broadcasting and the way that media conventions have totally like there's this whole sequence in, I mean, everybody remembers the Mad as Hell speech, but there's that whole sequence where there's a big debate about the news division becoming just part of going under the aegis of programming, and where the point of news is to entertain and to make money, not necessarily to provide, you know, the actual news itself. And there's this huge debate about, you know, like what kind of a moral debasement of the network it would be if the news department were ever answerable to the network as just another branch of programming. And at the time, it was, you know, it was sort of considered, you know, this doomsday scenario of what could happen someday in the future. And it is just such a stark reminder of how quickly things can change to watch that now and look at the way we are today. But to have seen that Mad as Hell sequence in the theater without anybody knowing what was coming, because there's a reason they show that every year at the Oscar reel, because it's just such an amazingly powerful scene. But I can't imagine I mean, you know, in 77 when Network came out, I mean, it's like post Vietnam, post Watergate. You know, it's all of that stuff, the lingering scars of all that, of the civil rights movement, and of the energy crisis, and the you know, economic implosion. Everybody's out of work, and you know, all of this stuff. And then I think for the first time to be in a theater where and hearing a guy verbalizing that in an age when there wasn't a Rush Limbaugh and there wasn't Glenn Beck, there wasn't Michael Savage, there wasn't Randy Rhoads, there wasn't anybody to get on a pulpit and just say what everybody was thinking. And then climaxes in that just sequence where they just show those tenement buildings from the outside and there's everybody screaming at their window. I mean, I can't imagine how great that would have been to see when you didn't know it was coming, when it catches you by surprise. So... well, that's like the longest snuff watch ever. So there you go. That's Sidney Lumet, dead 86. There goes your snuff watch for Monday. By the way, our good friend Jesus in the OC says, any guy who can direct both The Wiz and Network is effing ace in my book. The Wiz. Can I confess to you that I've never seen The Wiz all the way through? I've seen, you know, 20 minutes here and there. I don't think I've ever actually sat down and watched The Wiz.
You haven't missed anything.
Yeah, I want to believe that it's secretly like some sort of cult genius. But I mean, who knows? Maybe it is, maybe it ain't. That's, I think, the only story we've done so far. So let's do a handful more. Here's Don Taylor.
A slow speed pursuit on Friday through two California counties ended at a gas station in Davis, California, with the driver screaming while being dragged into the back of a patrol car. Citrus Heights police say they attempted to stop the man near Interstate 80. He refused to pull over and got onto the interstate heading west and led police and CHP in a slow speed chase. CHP says the pursuit never went over speeds of 30 miles per hour and at times was as slow as 4 miles per hour. The pursuit ended when the driver pulled into an AM/PM gas station. Officers had to put on a protective mask because the man was apparently spitting at them. As officers attempted to put the suspect in the car, he began yelling that he was not a U.S. citizen and that they had no rights to arrest him. Following is an excerpt of the suspect's rant.
And what is this? This is just rant one?
Yes.
Of the United States. Took my pants off. Look at this. I will sue for this. I will get repaid for this in my court, because my court is the jerk court of California.
I love
the courts. Do you know what the bar is? It's the British Accredited Registry. That's why lawyers are created by Britain, not America. It's a fake system. It's all for control.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Sick. It sounds at the beginning like they're hosing him with something.
No, and actually, I sent you a link to the video if you want to post the video. They're trying to drag him into the car, and he sees somebody in the camera, and he's just yelling at the camera that I'm not a citizen of the United States, and then says, you took my pants off at some point.
I think I must have missed that.
They may have accidentally yanked his pants down.
That's
when they were
wonderful.
Pulling him into the – because they were actually pulling him feet first into the back seat of the car, prone, because –
You know, can we just give it up for all the times that cops don't tase a guy who clearly has it coming? You know, where they just don't just go, let's just beat this guy until he quits moving. I mean, because it must be really tempting when you're just like, I don't get paid enough for this. And you're dragging some jag off into the back of your car. And, you know, and you're just like, well, should we just bludgeon him? I guess not. Let's just try to restrain him.
But what goes through your mind when you're in an automobile chase with somebody at 4 miles an hour?
That's the other thing. Like, and this is where? It was in L.A.?
California.
So you got to figure out.
Northern California. It's outside of Sacramento.
But they have all those, you know, like they're always unveiling like the non-lethal weapons and like the stuff that like the goo they can shoot you with that just like hardens and immobilizes you or whatever. I don't know why they have that. They don't have that for cars or something where they can just like, you know, they just spray like that caulking gun that hits your car and just stops it.
Well, actually, I don't know. I think it's early on in this. If you listen, you can hear somebody laughing in the background. I sort of got it's probably a cop.
Let's see if we can rant.
I'm not a citizen of the United States. Took my pants off. Look at this. I will sue for this. I will get repaid for this in my court, because my court is the jerk court of California.
That is really, really great. That's I'm gonna
say the jerk court.
Something. It's something like that.
The transcript I got. They say that he's saying, because my court isn't your court of California.
Ah.
So, yes. And then he does this whole thing that's like that the bar means British accredited registry. That's why lawyers are accredited by Britain, not America.
That may just be an approximation of an exact transcription of that may not be possible.
Not sure he's quite sure of what he's talking
about. I'm gonna save that, and I'm also gonna adjust that. It sounds like it's just in the left channel. I'm gonna mono that out so we can get both channels of that, and maybe it'll make an exact transcription easier. So that's fantastic. That's going on the list of all time great sound bites that we have. All right, wonderful.
Took my pants off.
That's, and I mean, it's like, and what is that even about? Like, do we know that they did, in fact, pants him?
I think he may have been accidentally pantsed a bit as they were pulling him into the car.
That's great. Wonderful.
So, standing at 102 feet, a Lego tower built in Brazil has broken the previous record set by Chile in 2008. Brazilian footballer Cafu placed the last block on the tower, which was built in the parking lot of a shopping center in Sao Paulo. Lego sent designers from Denmark for the world record attempt. The first Lego tower was built in London in 1988 and stood just over 15 meters. Since then, 53 cities have built towers in more than 30 countries. And now Brazil has the record.
And it's how tall?
102 feet tall.
All right. And it's made of Legos.
It's made out of Legos.
All right. This is like when... never mind. I was just going to start a whole Lego rant, but that's just dumb. That's just really, even for me, that's just a disproportionate use of my anger.
This guy, James May, I think he's one of the guys on Top Gear, if I'm correct.
Yes.
He has a show called Toy Stories on BBC, and he did a thing on Lego on the most recent season of it, where he worked with an engineer. He wanted to build a house out of Lego. And so he worked with these engineers to try and figure out how to build an entire house out of Lego, with using just some wood basically as guidelines, but no other support structures, just Lego. And it was quite difficult to do, but they built it in stairs going up. And then all the furniture was made out of Lego, and that was a lot less successful.
And it was a full-size, like, livable house?
Yeah, more or less. It's more of an art piece. He only lived in it for 24 hours to prove that he could.
The thing that I was going to say about Legos is that here's something I don't approve of. The idea that at some point in the last, I don't know, however many years, that if you look at, and I don't mean this to sound like a, you know, when I was a boy kind of a thing, but I mean, if you look at like a lot of Lego kits now, a lot of it seems to come pre-assembled. Far more of your Lego kit is pre-assembled now than I believe was the case at some point in the past.
Yeah, there are a lot more specialty pieces like window frames and door frames with hinges and things like that. But, you know, depending on what you're doing.
But I'm talking about where you get like the pirate kit and it's like the galleon just comes out as like one giant piece already put together.
Yeah, I mean, I got the...
Well, your Rubik's Cube comes solved.
Yeah, it's it's one of those things that it makes me sound like an old guy, so I try not to complain about.
Well,
it
I got the Green Army Man Lego kit from Toy Story 3 because the idea that it was Army Men but they were Legos just made my brain spinny, so I had to have that. And yeah, they have a little army jeep. And really, it was only about like six pieces to put the army jeep together.
So. Now people are just yelling at me for not having seen The Wiz.
I don't think living in it for 24 hours proves that you can live in it.
No.
I mean, you can sleep pretty much anywhere for one night.
Come on and ease on down the road.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah. That's
one of us was going to do it.
That is the extent of my Wiz knowledge, I believe.
So I believe we have a double clown watch, by the way. You have a clown story, I have a clown story.
I don't have a clown story as such. It's just a thing, and I will probably save my part of it actually for tomorrow. It's a little bit of a visual aid. Just real quickly, and then we'll talk more about it tomorrow. So my wife was at – so they built this – One of your fancier, more upscale Goodwills on Hawthorne just opened, and apparently it's like Hawthorne and like I don't know maybe like around 33rd or something. It's there was like a Hollywood Video or something there, and so now it's like half something else, half Goodwill. But apparently they're trying to give it a fresh new look. But she walked in, she found like the two. Do you ever see this? Do you ever go to like a thrift store and you see something on sale, and it's like you almost. Like you almost feel like you are getting away with something, like you're committing some sort of a crime by buying something at a thrift store for a very low price because you realize that they really ought to be selling it somewhere else for a lot more money. Not even because it's valuable like in an objective sense, just because it's awesome and you can't believe that they're selling it for like $1.50. Like I have this at home, I have this JFK bust, which is really like, I swear to you, one of the first things that Laura and I ever got is like a joint couple decoration for our home. Just this huge bust of JFK that I found at a Goodwill for like $5, which is just which is great because now we decorate it for all of the seasons. So during Christmas, we have little reindeer antlers that go on him, and the he has a Santa hat that we put on,
and like my oil portrait of Walter Cronkite
exactly
over the fireplace that I got at the St. Vincent de Paul thrift store.
And it's like you see it and you go like, who would get rid of this? And that's where you just, you know what it is, that's where you thank God for like an inattentive or ignorant family member who has no idea, like they're just cleaning out a loved one's possessions. They go, I don't know, it's just some crap, get rid of it. So she's at Goodwill over the weekend, and she finds two things. One is and it does, by the look of the paper and the sort of yellowing and the way that it is curling ever so slightly, it appears to be a vintage propaganda poster from the Soviet Union, which is just awesome.
And this was just at the Goodwill?
It was at the Goodwill for $10.
That's crazy.
And it was framed. That's the other thing. It's glorious. It has this, like, you know, sort of a stout, angry-looking Soviet woman, you know, sort of like a... You know, sort of like a...
That's redundant.
I mean, I guess that goes without saying, but she's just got, you know, angry, glaring, black eyes, you know, and she's just sort of large, but not in a fat way, sort of a could throw a punch and have you killed kind of a, you know, her whole family survived imprisonment in Gulag kind of way. But she's holding out with one hand this manifesto that I can't read because it's, you know, it's all Cyrillic. But with one hand, she's holding this manifesto toward you, the person looking at the poster. The other hand is thrown way up in the air as though she's going to be like going for a jump ball in the NBA, but not in a jazz hands kind of a way, sort of in a like a, you know, like a glory be to the motherland kind of a way. And then in the back behind her, and this is a very carefully done drawing, it's all in that classic Soviet black, white, and red color scheme. So she's holding a manifesto and the other hand is in the air, and then behind her is a forest of bayonets sticking up. It's just nothing
wow.
but bayonets filling her. And then it says something big and aggressive with an exclamation mark at the top. So something big in Russian, you know, like Petrushka, you know, or whatever. And you're just like, I don't know. Yes. But I think the only reason it was still there is because it was just hanging on the wall. And I think people must have assumed it was just like part of a decoration or that it was just. And so Lara finally went, is that for sale? And the guy went, $10. And she was like, sold. So she got that. So that's now in my office at home. But she also got a 1955 edition of what a thing that I have always heard about, but I have never seen, which is the Book of Knowledge. And the Book of Knowledge, which was like a one volume sort of, it was like an encyclopedia sampler.
So this is like a companion piece to the atlas I gave you. So now you can have backdated, out of date information about everything in the world.
It's exactly that. And so it is. It's the Book of Knowledge annual. And so I guess the deal is every year they would just pick like a smattering of interesting subjects, sort of like an encyclopedia, but they would just kind of cram. It was very much like when you get a sampler CD, you know, from a record label or something, and it would be like, you know, here's what's coming out on Earache Records this fall, and it would be like one song from each artist or something. That's what this is. It's got, for example, a 3-page essay by Arthur Godfrey about the magic of broadcasting and radio, and he says. He has a whole thing about, you know, imagine, you know, when you're broadcasting, don't imagine you're speaking to a large group of people. Imagine that you're speaking to one person, say your mom or dad at the ice cream parlor. But most importantly is this 4-page section on clowns, which is just glorious. I mean, aww. First of all, why would there be a 4-page section on clowns of all things in here? I mean, I know you're trying to get kids to read it, but I mean, goddamn. And also, unsurprisingly, all of the clowns look evil. I mean, every goddamn one of them. One of them
yes.
looks evil and like Phil Hendry. So that's doubly unnerving. it also contains, I swear to God, I'm not making this up. I'll get photos of these. I mean, I don't even, some of these you have to wait and see tomorrow because I don't want to spring some of these on you. It contains phrases such as, clowning often runs in families.
Here's the thing. Because I have this like fear.
Don, many clowns are of Italian descent.
I have this fear and displeasure of clowns.
So, wait, clowns are like the mob?
Yes.
They run in families?
Exactly.
And because I have this thing about clowns, the phrase clown and spring it on you always seem to go hand in hand. Like, if I was afraid of spiders, people wouldn't be always, like, trying to spring spiders on me. But no, it's funny Don's afraid of clowns.
Don, the left cheeks of many clowns are permanently hard and dry. I swear
what?
To God it says that.
Why?
I don't know. I'm just picking out of context sentences. Let's see. We've also, let's see, what else do we have? There have always been clowns, Don. Let's see. To become a true clown, one must be true to one's own self. And then it notes here, this is another standalone sentence. A clown, Don, is something more than human. If a clown was... And this is from the Book of Knowledge 19, and it's got all these great World of Tomorrow photos. This is from 19, because it's before the moon landing, 1950. This is from the 1950 Book of Knowledge. Listen to this now. A clown anywhere is something more than human. If he is pricked, he would not bleed. If poisoned, he would not die. If he suffered, he was not in pain. And I don't know why they say that. Presumably it makes sense in some kind of context. But then there's a picture of... I'll just show it to you. I'll put a picture of this up tomorrow. But there's a scary clown.
Oh, God.
Okay, but then the clowns have captions. Apparently, these are like some of the most influential clowns throughout history. The caption here is glorious. It just says, I guess he must have been like a prop clown. Because the caption, there's a picture of this horrible, evil clown. And then the caption reads, Lou Jacobs, inventor of absurd contrivances. I don't even know what that means.
Oh, bless you, Lou Jacobs.
By the way. Italy is the cradle of clowning. So just okay, there then. You go. From the Book of Knowledge, $2, this book. So there you go. That's a
good band name. Absurd Contrivances.
Absurd Contrivances.
I totally want that on my business card. You know, the inventor of absurd contrivances. Absurd Contrivances. It's awesome. Clowns are something more than human, Dawn. Clowning often runs in families. So it's,
well, then that should lead us into our clown watch.
Here's your clown watch for Tuesday, or Monday, rather, right here in the Rick Emerson Radio program.
Professional clown Valerie Bowell, something like that, 35, of Roland Park, Kansas, is usually in the business of making people smile as the singing and juggling bunny lady, a role for which she dons a fuzzy pink and green costume with ears. By the way, here's one of her costumes, one of her many costumes. She also has a full bunny suit that's like fuchsia. She seems to have many outfits in which she...
I'm not a fan. Normally, that's the thing I'd find strangely hot, but not so much in her case, no.
And she sings songs like this.
My name is Sally, and I'm a little bunny rabbit.
Well, she wasn't singing. After an encounter with a TSA agent at Philadelphia International Airport, Bowell faces charges of harassment after a TSA agent inquired about a basket of eggs she was carrying, which she says had just passed through an airport security X-ray machine.
She wasn't investigating my eggs. I had already been through the X-ray machines. She said, what are those? And I said, well, they're eggs filled with confetti. You want to see what's inside? Here you go. You win. Let's find out together. And I put it on her head. And I didn't think anything of it.
She sounds like a bit of a chain-smoking bunny clown.
Yeah, yeah. The TSA agent was somehow not amused to have the hostile bunny lady crack an egg on her head and shower her with confetti. So police authorities grabbed the bunny lady and handcuffed her and threw her into airport jail for 3 hours. She's due in court in Philadelphia in September on misdemeanor harassment charges. And a TSA spokesman said that they're cooperating with local authorities in the case, but declined to comment further.
And so where does she apply her clown trade?
Philadelphia.
And so she is a clown and a rabbit, or a rabbit and a clown.
And a community DJ.
Really?
Yeah.
She's an imposing woman.
And just kind of horrible.
All right, there's your clown watch for Jesus God.
She's actually lucky that she's not being charged with assault if she like smacked somebody on the head.
You know, I was having this discussion with Laura about this because the TSA thing. So I can never figure this out. So you can't take liquids through security, but can you take food through security? Like if you're getting on a plane, you have like a sandwich in your bag. Can you take that? I can't get a straight answer on whether you can take food through or not. It seems if you can't take a soda through, they're not going to let you take like a slice of pizza through. But I have heard people say that you can take food through. I just don't know. Has anyone flown?
I don't know. And although it's a good question, since my wife and Stella are on a red eye to Ohio on Wednesday night, and I'm sure she's going to want things like Cheerios with her. I was wondering, and obviously there must be a way around this because people do it all the time. But if I were to fly with Stella, I would need to take formula. I wouldn't be able to make that formula ahead of time. I also don't think that they're going to let me just waltz through with a bottle full of white powder.
No, no, probably not.
So I'm not sure how one does that.
And
there must be a way.
You don't have bosoms, so they may have a whole. Well, then there's that. I mean, well, you hear those stories which may be anecdotal about, like, you know. Well, if you say it's breast milk, drink some for me or whatever. And I just don't. I don't know if they actually. That's a good question, actually. Doesn't it seem? Well, didn't we have that story in Legion of News about there's a. At the Fukushima place, the robot that can detect 7,500 different types of chemicals, yeah. And then also toxic, you know, whatever, and nuclear this. I mean, it's a robot that can detect, like, anything, you know, dangerous and identify all kinds of substances. Doesn't it seem like at the TSA they ought to be able to have something where they just go, like a Geiger counter, where they just kind of go, and they wave, and it tells you what, like a tricorder, where it just tells you, like, breast milk. You know, or just, you know, or breast milk, you know, with nitroglycerin in it or something, where they just tell you what a substance is.
Yeah, but that would mean that they were actually doing this for the purposes of trying to, like, maintain some sort of safety and not just maintain the illusion
of process
safety.
Yeah, I guess.
A lot of process these days.
That's a good question. When are you flying?
Well, I'm not flying with the kid anytime soon.
Okay, but if you were to fly, you would have to, like, bring that along. That's a good question. I actually have no. There must be a thing that somebody has had to deal with.
Yes,
at this point,
it can't just be mothers that fly with children.
Let's see. So we did Clown Watch. We did the Snuff Watch. The others should probably wait because we got to do. Do you watch The Killing by chance on AMC?
No.
You know, here's the thing. Even before I said when I got to the, do you watch? I thought. No, the answer to that is no. I think, little side note, I mentioned this at the top of the show, that my wife was incredibly hungover on Sunday morning. There was Saturday night at around 4 a.m. into Sunday morning. That's when her world turned very unpleasant on her. I was not around for the drinking. I was just at home when she arrived. And I can count on, as I said earlier, fewer than five fingers the number of times I have ever seen my wife monumentally, galactically, you know, just effed up. And Saturday night was one of those nights. And she was very, very, very regretful about that on Sunday morning. And I was wondering about the worst possible song to have playing, like, in the next room while you were hungover. And
it's a great idea.
And this is, well, at some point we'll have to put that together. It was prompted by this. This is Alan Hawkshaw. This is from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And I was imagining, like, if you could, you know, back when you remember back when you used to have roommates or something, and just imagine being really, really hungover and... You know, right outside your bedroom door, the guy in the living room has just got this on while he's doing some feather dusting. I mean, I imagine that would run for about 30 seconds before you took, like, a vase to the back of his head or something. But I emailed Ryan and I said, hey, you know, you ought to put together, like, a top five worst songs to hear while you're hungover. And you said that your iTunes library was actually, like, at zero.
It's zeroed right now. It is not. Nothing has been – nothing has electronically been replaced yet from the burglary.
Which is the thing I hadn't even thought of, that in addition to, you know, all of the other various degrees of unpleasantness, you got to rebuild your music library, your electronic music library.
Here's the thing, like, you know, iTunes, you contact them and they'll I'm set up. Everything that I've ever purchased that's still available in the iTunes library, I can download again for free.
Really?
That's going to take forever. That's like 8 years worth of iTunes downloads.
I hadn't really thought about that too, because it's like,
they've got them all,
and it's I haven't even gone and set up the account to look at it yet. But
did they
send
you a list?
I was told that as soon as I go into it, it will all be there in the download queue.
Oh,
now,
my God. But
the size of that download queue is going to be – I mean, it really was, you know, it was, you know, was it 02 or 03 when I started – you know, it was pretty soon into the whole thing. I mean, and there was probably, you know, over the years, there's probably $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 worth of iTunes purchases.
God, and just – I mean, even the time it would take to go through and sort through the download queue to pull out the things you didn't want to bother to download again would be difficult. I mean – Jesus, I can't even imagine that. I mean, it's like at one point I transferred from I don't know. I went from using this MP3 kind of device from Creative. I had a Creative Zen, and I went from that to my iPod. And so as a result, I had to pull everything off, put it on my, you know, computer, and then and it's like, that's really. I mean, that Creative Zen held 30 gigs worth of music. That's a lot.
Yeah,
that's a lot. And somebody said, well, you don't have to transfer all of it. But to figure out what you want to trade, you have to sort through all of it to figure out the wheat from the chaff. And so you are still effectively moving it all and looking at it all because you got to figure out what stays and what goes.
Yeah. And, you know, this weekend would be the perfect time if I had replaced the desktop yet and had everything set up to just start it downloading everything, lock the house, fly to Palm Springs for 5 days, come home and hope that it's done.
That is it almost takes you back to the early days of the internet where, like, you start to download something and you just do it at night and then, when you get home from work the next day, it's there. Wow. So that's a great thing that Apple has. I didn't know that. You tell them, like, hey, we got robbed, and they just go, like, no problem.
I had contacted them. I just wanted a list of everything that I'd purchased, which I assumed they could do. And I figured, okay, I'll have to turn this in with insurance. It'll have prices and everything else on it, and, you know, then we'll get money for it. And instead I get an email back saying, you know, here's what we'll do. Everything will be there when you're ready for it and ready to download.
That's fantastic. So. Good for them. In just a moment here, we will do our recap of last night's episode of The Killing, Season 1, Episode 3. You can watch that at AMC. We should take a moment to observe that this, the Rick Emerson radio program and Cavalcade of Amusements, is brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find them at squireselectric.com. That is Squires Electric. .com, or you can call 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. And if you are going to be renting a place, you're going to be buying a place, or maybe you are going to be renting or selling it to somebody else, are you going to be moving your business from one location to two to three, or are you going to be moving your business into your home, anything like that, you want to make sure that everything works as advertised, that everything functions properly and without incident. And you can do that by contacting Squires Electric, because it's, you know, it's not like just you're like your garbage disposal doesn't work properly, or it's like, you know, you find that there's this one section of the carpet where things have been worn away a little bit. I mean, if things aren't working in the electrical system, that's bad in just the deepest place and the deepest way. And so you don't want to have to screw around with that, because I'll put it this way, the possible downside of, like, I don't know, your toilet not flushing correctly is, you got a day of unpleasantness, you got to plunge, you got to replace the toilet, you know, and it's like, how bad could that really, you know, you don't want that, but how bad could that possibly go for it? The downside of your electrical system not working properly, or some issue in there that you haven't properly chased down and solved, that could be a large-scale irritation to you. Let's put it that way. So you want to contact Squires Electric at 503-252-1609, or you can go to squireselectric.com. And they are proud sponsors of the Rick Emerson radio program. So please tell them you heard it here, won't you, please? It's 503-252-1609, squireselectric.com. Before we wrap things up for the day, we should say that joining us later on this week, I believe Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be here. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will be stepping in on Thursday and Friday. Mr. Big Jim Willig will return with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. But without further ado, we have our recap of last night's episode of The Killing on AMC, Season 1, Episode 3. And somebody asked me about that because they just started watching it. The deal is, the very first week was the first two episodes back-to-back. They did a double-length pilot. So episodes 1 and 2 aired the first week. So now the second week, we are at, in fact, episode 3. Dawn Taylor, last night's episode of The Killing.
Wow. Wow. It just continues along at its sort of glacial pace, but it's...
It's a deliberate pace.
Yeah, and it's just wrenching, though. It's just... again, like I mentioned before, watching, being privy to what's going on with the family of the murdered girl while you're watching the investigation into her murder helps keep it grounded in this sense of tragedy that most police procedurals really don't. And every time we're given a little bit more information now, it seems like, about what happened to her, it's just all the more horrible.
Right, right.
And in this case, it was, someone videotaped her being raped by two of her classmates and in the place where we know she was murdered. And so, but who made that videotape?
Right. And it's,
and who sent it to, like, one of her teachers?
And the thing about the show is that the killing conjures up one of the most difficult tones to master, which is dread. Dread is like a polar twin to whimsy. Comedy is one thing, and belly laughs and chuckles and whatever, but whimsy is very, very difficult to create and maintain, especially for the long haul. Dread is, you can startle people or shock them or horrify them or you know, revulse them. But having dread, which is just more of an atmospheric thing and more of a vibe, for lack of a better word, you know, it's not as easy as just that. You can't just turn on a fog machine and have a dripping noise in the background. I mean, it's difficult to do. And this show just gives you that sense of just, it is the sense of just something wrong, of just something sort of, you know, rotted, having, in a figurative sense, of just having happened. There's just an ick in the air.
Yeah, I realized watching this episode that in some ways it reminds me quite a bit of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Only without the gleeful goofiness that David Lynch always brings to all of his stuff. Because this is serious filmmaking. It doesn't have that cha-cha-cha-cha, like giddiness that David Lynch has with some of his stuff. It has that, but it has that same sense of sort of gloomy dread, like you said.
I think that the show gets out of the way of its own production value, by which I mean, you know, a show like Twin Peaks, and, you know, and not to take anything away from that show, because I know that people are very passionate about it, but the thing about David Lynch is, you know, he can be an effective filmmaker and an effective storyteller, but it's like David Lynch and filmmakers of his type, they want to multitask, in that they want to tell you this story and show you this movie, but they also at the same time want you to be impressed by their production design and by the way that it looks, or by the color scheme, or by a particular visual mannerism that they are using. The thing about a show like The Killing is that all of those atmospherics and all of the production design and the choices in terms of lighting and framing and blocking and color and the palette, that's all in service of doing the job. And the job is to show you a very, very well-done, gripping, taut story. So while the show is beautiful to look at, you can tell they're not doing it to show off. It's all in service of the end, which is to creep you out in a compelling, gripping way.
And I think it's also... really a credit to how well the show is made, that there's sort of three spokes, you know, to the wheel, where you've got the family, you've got the police investigation, and you've got the mayoral candidate,
right,
who's one of whose cars her body was found in. So he's tied to this somehow, or someone in his campaign is tied to it possibly somehow. And the thing is that to me is the weakest of the three stories, but I'm still fascinated by it, even though at this time we really don't know how it's connected to the other
right.
two parts, other than the fact that, you know, his campaign owned the car that her body was found in. So how you know, at this point, it's really that it almost seems like a tertiary story about a guy running for mayor and doesn't have a lot to do with the rest of it. And yet it's still really interesting.
At the risk of just being the guy who compares every single thing ever to The Wire, they are doing a little bit of that thing where it's the multiple storylines that don't seem, as you said, they don't seem connected, or they don't seem more than tangentially connected. And then, but you get the sense that everything sort of draws closer together. It's funny, Lara had not seen the pilot, and so I had her watch the pilot last night. I watched it with her. And at the end of the pilot, which is about 90 minutes in length, she said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said, "Well, you know, that's it until, you know, the next episode, which is tonight." And she said, "Well, they're not going to solve it?" And I said, "No." And she was actually, and she loved it, but she was, it's interesting that she was, we've gotten so used to episodic and self-contained television, especially in the world of, you know, of crime dramas and of procedurals, where maybe they draw something out for an episode or two, if it's a very, you know, if it's a two-parter or a crossover episode or something. And it took her a second to recalibrate her expectations to the fact that they weren't going to be, you know, it was going to take 18 episodes or 13 episodes or whatever it is to solve this out. So I guess we're on, if the premise of the show is that every episode is a day of the investigation, we're already 3 episodes in, 3 hours in, 3 days in, but it never feels padded, ever. In fact, quite the opposite. I mean, you get the sense that it's like, how are they going to get everything into this? Because every moment counts, and there's not an ounce of a second of wasted screen time in this show. Also, the idea that that the cop, Holder, I guess his name is not a rookie, but, you know, the sort of the new guy,
yeah,
who has such a possibility to just be rendered as a cliche. The great thing is that they sort of are slowly unspooling the characters to where you just get a little bit more sense of to who they are and how they operate and how they behave. And they are making a very believable gradual transition from the two lead detectives not getting along at all to having, I think, that bond that any two people have when they work together over a long period of time. And you can see it very, very slowly happening, but in a way that you buy automatically.
It's really interesting to see a show, too, where one of the lead characters is a woman who's a homicide detective, and she's playing the traditional gender role with the fiancé,
right,
who's going, but honey, you're supposed to be like moving into our new house and we have a wedding to plan. And she's just saying, I got this job. I got this murder to investigate. I'm sorry. And not, she doesn't feel the need to like placate.
Right.
You know, it is almost a cliche of murder mystery movies and TV shows that the man is the hard-boiled detective, and the woman is saying, honey, you're never home for dinner.
Maybe it's the job.
Yeah, and in this case, it's actually, we got a gender reversal there. And she is equally unapologetic about, you know, she's a little frustrated with him for just not understanding that she found this body and she's got to, like, continue with this investigation.
Let me ask you this. Her fiancé, Callum Keith Rennie. Okay, Dawn, you're a lady. Attractive or not?
I don't know if he's attractive or not because I just remember
he's a Cylon
from Battlestar Galactica, and so I find him really skeezy.
Okay,
because he's like the Cylon that held Starbuck captive and was creepy to her,
because
and just raping her over and over again and raising her mind and stuff.
I guess rapey robot would tend to
that
does color one's perception of.
I mean, he might be like hot as balls, but he's a rapey robot in my mind.
Okay, Laura was making the observation that she found it interesting that the sort of, you know, the kind of blue collar couple, which is Michelle Forbes and her husband, you know, Rosie's parents, that they were, you know, in even though he's a husky man, that they were, you know, they were conventionally attractive people, but she felt so, and that yet Holder, the sidekick cop, and the fiance Keith Callum Rennie, that she found them just utterly unappealing. She found them just very, very. I think she described them as beaky and weasel like. So it's a show that doesn't necessarily do things, you know, that they don't necessarily play to type or to expectation. But speaking of creepy, how unbelievably creepy looking is that? Is it that Jasper guy?
Yeah. El Diablo?
Except
he turned out to not be El Diablo.
He just looks like some sort of, he looks like a Gringotts goblin, you know, or something. And he's just in that sex video at the end, which is just all kinds of disturbing. And
well, you know, the one guy, Chris is the other guy.
Yeah.
The guy Chris, he's got hair like Seth Aaron.
Yeah, he really does.
He's like a skinny, skinny, scrawny skateboard punk Seth Aaron.
Yeah, it's, you do have that. They do have that thing that they've planted early on where, just as in, it's almost another little nod to Seven, where the character of Holder said to the family, like, you know, we'll get the guy, when the family says, will you? And you can tell that she has gotten to the point where she never makes that promise. She just says, we'll do everything we can. But he just flat out said, like, we'll get him. And over the course...
And she also lied to the mom, too.
Saying she didn't suffer.
Yeah.
And it's... And that's an interesting thing, too, because that she's been so much about not gilding the lily, but a thing like that, but not masking the truth, of being very blunt and plain spoken,
right,
or just not answering the question. But there we saw that she did flat out lie to the family, which she sort of chastised her partner for saying, like, we'll catch the guy. But you can already sense three episodes in that it's like, you know, girl who may or may not be innocent, but clearly killed in a horrible way, and now like this skeezy sex video, and it's just, and these horrible kids that you just kind of want to pummel, and they are, you can tell they're already ratcheting up just like this sort of great weird thing in the audience of you know, when they finally, because you can tell it's only going to get more horrible from here.
Well, and yeah, and I think that's the level of dread right there, is that there's a sense we do know that we have an expectation that a show will pull its punches early on and then unveil even worse things later. They're not going to, like, give us something horrible at the beginning. They're going to give us the really horrible stuff later. So I think there's this sense where you just go, dear God, we've already seen a dead girl drowned in the trunk of a car and this...
being assaulted by a guy in a devil mask.
This horrible bloody mattress in a dank basement with handprints all over the walls where the crime happened. That was episode two. Episode three, we see the rape video with the guy in the devil mask. So yeah, there's this part of you going, oh my God, what more are they going to tell us?
And there's... And so to me, I see these two roads converging of just like the escalating horror and the escalating levels of like however awful, you know, whatever horrible thing happened to this girl, which, of course, as the viewer, you know, you get this, you know, this like this sort of, you know, like the desire for punishment, for some sort of vengeance. You know, you feel like evil must be punished. So you can tell that they're going to keep ratcheting up and just escalating this desire to see like someone pay for what was done to this girl. And then You know, and that, of course, is, you know, that's through the character of Holder, who has, you know, told the family that, like, we will get the guy. And you sense that he is, you know, in a traditional program, he would be the guy who then delivered that justice. But you also know you're watching a very different kind of program. So as all of these things converge, you already wonder, like, are they going to subvert that expectation? Are they going to give you the big cathartic payoff of evil is punished? Or is it going to end in some way that is totally different from that? And it's just, it's, you just don't know how it's going to end. You have no idea. I mean, it's only three episodes in, but I mean, I don't think, you know, 10 episodes in, I don't think I'll be any closer to knowing how it's going to end. It really is a, if you're not watching it, you really ought to. It is a, The Killing on AMC. It's just a fantastic show. I have one prediction, and I'm not the only person. This is not a spoiler, just a guess, just a prediction. I think Seamus actually said this too, but I agree with this, and I was already sort of thinking that when they showed the sex tape of Rosie with the two guys, it is going to come out that perhaps the sex tape is not what it appears to be, that it appears that she is being assaulted against her will.
But it's actually a consensual thing, and she's got a thing going with both
guys. She may have, sort of bizarre love triangle. Not even love triangle, but some sort of strange polyamorous relationship going with the two. I do, by the way, also just as a viewer of television, I read a great amount of significance into the fact that one of the kids has the last name of Eccles, because I immediately then associate with Damien Eccles, who's one of the West Memphis Three guys who is believed by many people to be a wrongly convicted young man. So I am reading a great amount of significance into that, which may or may not turn out to be anything. But so that is Sundays at 9 o'clock on AMC. That is The Killing. All right. Well, we have to end this. I have to find something chipper to play after this music, and we've got to not put this as the final segment of the show anymore. Jesus God. I don't think I'm walking on sunshine, but I'll find something here.
By the way, if you're not watching The Killing, that's the music from the show. That's just what it sounds like all the time.
That's what the show
when
feels
you're watching
like
the show.
In your heart. All right. Well, let me just.
It's kind of grim.
I don't think I can watch
it. Washing it away. Ryan White from The Oregonian. When is the next? When is your next piece coming out?
You're
going to be traveling and doing some stuff.
Yeah, but, watch the blog, oregonlive.com/music, Oregonian music on Twitter for all of the fun and sights and sounds and weirdness from Coachella this
excellent
weekend.
Ryan White, read him in print in The Oregonian, online at oregonlive.com/music. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. After a brief interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News, followed by an encore of today's Rick Emerson Show, and so forth. We thank you for joining us. It is Monday, April 11th, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.